to the end.
Welcome to episode 42 of the Skip to the End podcast. As ever, I'm Ben.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Mark.
And it's a big one this week. It's a film that we've been waiting for a long time. Everyone has. We're going to be reviewing Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice. A little bit excited, chaps?
Yeah.
It's a big one.
Big film.
And now on to the film. Adam, now I know you've got a bit of trepidation coming into this. I'm going to discuss the film in detail later on. You're feeling a bit about this the same way I was feeling about Deadpool.
Yeah.
Because obviously everyone who listens to our show knows how much you love Batman as a character. So we quite literally need justice to be done by that character, don't we?
It is, and that's the case, isn't it? It's like when you say with Deadpool, it was very mixed reviews, shall we say, from the panel here.
Yes.
We had Gemma at the time as well. So I'm very interested to hear both your thoughts on the film, and then obviously I'll give you my own as a comic book fan.
Excellent news. We've also got a big topic. We're going to discuss the top three dramatic performances from comedic actors and actresses. When we come to that topic in a minute, you can explain to me how you interpreted that. We'll get into the nitty-gritty of that. Adam, what was our rewatch this week?
Spirited Away.
Very excited.
Ghibli's
by that.
Miyazaki's wonderful animated tale. I don't think I'm ruining it by saying the word wonderful. I think we all know. We've all talked about Miyazaki and the Studio Ghibli's animation before.
I think, Mark, both you and I had it in our top five or top three animated films of all time.
So Rich definitely did, didn't he? Booth, yeah. I think Booth had it as one of his.
I think that was about the days when we did a top five.
Yeah.
I think they were. I'm not doing that again.
Can't do it anymore. The shows are too busy. You just can't fit it in.
Sorry. Too much going on. We've got Raging Bullseye as well.
Exactly. What year are we going to skip back to, Mark?
1988.
The year of my birth.
Ooh.
As an actor, of course.
And we'll also be taking listener questions, giving away a cool prize, all the other malarkey that we do every damn time. So, let's get started. Topic of discussion this week is top three dramatic performances from comedic actors or actresses. And I left this up to you guys as to how you wanted to interpret this. My interpretation was I was looking at people who had either come from sketch comedy or stand-up comedy backgrounds or who had done historically comedic films only, but then out of nowhere came and did a big dramatic performance. Did you guys interpret it in any other way, Mark?
That's exactly it. I just wanted to pick someone who has literally done comedy after comedy after comedy, then shocked me with an actual serious performance. Mm-hmm. So,
how about you?
I did very similar to that. I kind of looked at anyone who had been in sort of comedy films as a rule, literally that's all they'd really done. Maybe they'd done one or two small dramatic roles before, but hadn't really broken the mold necessarily.
Yeah.
But generally anyone who was well known at the time for their comedic value.
Absolutely.
And then broke the mold and really came out and said, here I am as a dramatic actor.
Yeah.
This is what I can do.
Okay, well let's see what picks we've gone for then. Mark, number one.
We always rip this guy to pieces. He's won awards. He's one of the worst actors going, but I'm going to give him his credit when it's due. Adam Sandler for Punch Drunk Love.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't believe I'm saying this, and I'm going to praise him for about 5 minutes now. Yeah. This performance is incredible. I'm so used to him being Happy Gilmore and all these Waterboy and all these silly over-the-top, even those annoying voices. But in this film, he's depressed. He's low. And he shows those emotions like some of the best actors go in. And I can't believe I'm saying these words because he's known on this podcast for us. Well, he's the first ever person to win back-to-back Skippies.
Yeah, back-to-back worst actor Skippies.
Of all time. Yeah. But he plays the role of Barry.
Tommy
I want to say the surname. Is it Egan? It could be Egan. I'm not going to have listeners going.
Is it Barry from EastEnders? is that who plays the role?
He plays the role of Barry, and it's a really depressing low. Who's always like he's overshadowed by his sister in his life, and you always see these emotions of him just literally looking like
See, that's quite interesting, because in Jack and Jill, it's the other way around. Like, he plays the sister that's really been overshadowed. That's, you see, maybe we've been harsh on Jack and Jill. Maybe that's what we should be looking at. Maybe it was a satirical piece on Punch Drunk Love.
Paul Thomas Anderson had seen it as a vision, was like, I'm going to go before this gets made into a comedy. But I'm going to give him his credit. I think it's... Have you both seen the film?
I have. Actually, Paul Thomas Anderson is one of my favourite directors, so yeah.
And do you agree? Do you think he's a strong performance
It's a very good performance. It's a very... I love how he's... has this sort of anger always just below the surface that explodes out of him at times. I think it's a very, very cool performance.
I think it's a very good performance. I think you've cheated slightly, because personally, I don't think he's known for comedy acting at all. I think he's terrible and unfunny.
Or acting.
So, but never mind, I'll let that slide.
You're saying Pixels is not a masterpiece?
Well, Ben gave it 6 out of 10. Yeah.
Better than Deadpool.
Well, that's my first choice. Well,
normally I would throw it to Adam here, but I want to keep this going, because I too have got Adam Sandler in my list, but it's not for Punch Drunk Love.
Click.
Okay. It's not Click. Oh, okay. It is not Click, no. It's for a film called Rain Over Me. Have either of you seen this?
A lot of people on social media said this, and I haven't, and it's like, right, if people are talking about it, I need to get on it.
It's very good. He plays a character whose wife and children were in the vicinity of the Twin Towers when 9/11 struck, and his whole family died. And he's a dentist who was kind of a lively, outgoing person prior to this, but then when his family were taken from him, he became introverted and wouldn't really go out into the world. And his friend from college, played by Don Cheadle, comes back into his life and tries to bring him out of his shell. And it's a really, really upsetting and sad performance from Sandler. It's really, really moving, really affecting, actually. And I think he is very good in Punch Drunk Love, as we've said, but I think he's even better in Rain Over Me. It was one of those that at the time people kind of said, you know, people could throw his awards his way for this and not just Skippies and Razzies, positive awards. But he is so, so good in it, and it's so sad, that film.
What's curious here then is, as you've both chosen him, he's in your list for two different films, two different performances as well. Is it incredibly frustrating when you see him constantly going into roles like Jack and Jill?
Yeah, it is.
And the Cobbler.
It is, because even something...
The Cobbler? I still need to see that.
It is, because even something like Funny People, which is I hate the word dramedy, but it is kind of that. Mm. He plays quite a dark character in that, and that's not an out-and-out, you know, knockabout film like Happy Gilmore. And again, even in that, you look at him and think, this guy has acting chops. He is just so lazy that he doesn't use them.
Yeah.
And so it is frustrating, Adam. You're absolutely right. It's when you watch something like The Ridiculous Six and you think, you lazy twat. Because not only are you a talented dramatic actor, as we've just discussed, you are genuinely a funny guy when you wish to be, when you look at things like Happy Gilmore. Now, you're not doing either. Yeah. You're just doing these movies for a paycheck so you can go on holiday with David Spade.
That's exactly what he spends every penny on.
And Paul Blart Mall Cop.
Well, you know, wouldn't you go on holiday with President Paul
That's
Blart?
That's true, I would, yeah. I bet they get to go on Air Force One.
The problem is now is that he won't probably ever do a serious film again, because he's doing the Netflix deals, which are all comedies, and they're, like you said, they're not even funny anymore, and he's just literally just going to fizzle out.
There's a trailer been released on Netflix for his next Netflix film, where he co-stars with, wait for it, David Spade, and it looks absolute shite. I couldn't even
tell. Does it happen to be in like Marbella?
Probably. It'll be somewhere hot and sunny. He had tattoos. I think he's playing a ruffian of some sort.
But a ruffian?
Some sort of local street tough.
Be sure to check that out on Netflix soon.
That's worth your subscription fee.
Come on, Adam, give us an Adam Sandler film.
No. Unfortunately, all the good ones are taken. I'm going to lead off with it. It's, to be honest, it's an actor in a film I've spoken about on numerous occasions already, but I couldn't leave it out of the list. There's no way in hell I could leave it out of the list. Dead Poets Society, Robin Williams.
You bloody love that film, don't you?
I do. It's such a good film. It's so amazing. The dramatic performance from someone like him at the time. It was 1989, we did a skip back last time.
Yeah.
So it was kind of the first time he'd really been seen in a serious role at all. I mean, I talk about Good Will Hunting and things like that, but you know, he had proven his pedigree before Good Will Hunting and how good he was in these roles. And this was it. So someone coming from the background of not only stand-up comedy, but things like Mork and Mindy and all of that. So Whose Line Is It Anyway? He did things on there. Mm. He was really known for sort of sketch comedy, stand-up comedy, and his comedic acting. So for him to come out of left field and do something like this was just phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, unlike Adam Sandler, he went on and proved that he could do it in several other incarnations as well.
Yeah.
Was it 1 hour photo when he was that guy?
Oh,
that was
so good.
That was mind-blowing. It was too good. It was like, that is really eerie.
That's my favourite performance of his, comedic or dramatic.
Oh, definitely. 1 hour photo. I'd probably agree with you on that. I think 1 hour photo, he is...
Popeye.
Well, yeah. and we're forgetting Hook as well, aren't we? I mean,
I do love Mrs. Doubtfire though. That is actually genuinely.
It's a really serious role. He's trying to get his kids back. But no, it is fantastic. It's a great performance. I've spoken about Dead Poets Society as much as I probably can.
Yeah.
Ever. If you haven't seen it by now, what are you doing? Go and watch it. Mm-hmm. It's got to be on my list.
Fair enough.
I'm going to follow on with a film I've talked about again recently. It's going to be Steve Carell as Frank in Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So again, we always associate him as Michael Scott. We associate him as just like, you know, 40-year-old virgin. But this, again, it's a very depressing role. He plays the character of a gay, is it a scholar guy?
He's a Proust scholar.
Yeah. And it's a really, really low, depressing role. But again, you're still warm to this character because it's him. But again, I've never seen him act like this before. It's a real... did he get Oscar nominated?
I think his first nomination was Foxcatcher.
Yeah. But again, Foxcatcher, a serious role he does, but I think this shit's all over Foxcatcher.
Was him just doing a Mr. Burns.
Simpson,
eh? This is it. I mean, we spoke about Foxcatcher when we reviewed it, and none of us really seems to take to it at all.
No.
But Carell's another one where he has gone on to kind of do a few more serious roles.
Big Short.
Big Short. He was absolutely fantastic in that. And that was less of a sort of a comedy role. It was a vicious Michael Scott.
I
found in The Big Short. But he's another actor who went on and carried on that sort of dramatic.
And I have faith that he won't do a Sandler. He won't go and do any old crap, you know.
He's not that kind of comedian, is he? Just to churn out shit.
I love him in is it Crazy Stupid Love? When he's kind of serious and kind of funny, but I love him in that.
Yeah. But I would be quite happy to find out that Steve Carell did go and sign a big deal and was just using it to go on holiday with John Krasinski.
Him and Rainn Wilson.
And BJ Novak or something.
Amazing.
But I think Little Miss Sunshine was the first serious one he did.
Yeah.
I think he did kind of maybe a couple of more light-hearted or dramedy type things before that, but that was the first sort of, you know, he was suicidal, wasn't he? I'm sure he walks around with slit wrists at one point.
It's a dark role, but he does it brilliantly. And the fact is, then he did break away from it again, do comedy again, and like you said, we've seen him most recently in The Big Short, and he was unbelievable. So I look forward to more films from him.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to go with a good friend of his then. You all know that I am a fully paid up member of the Will Ferrell fan club. He's a walking god to me. Not only do I think he is the funniest actor on earth, I think he is the funniest man on earth. I also think he is a massively underrated dramatic actor. He's done a few dramatic performances, but the best one for me by a mile is Everything Must Go.
Oh, nice.
Have you both seen this?
I've got it in my list.
Have you really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm chuffed. For those of you who haven't seen it, because it is a little seen film, he plays a guy, he's an alcoholic, and his alcoholism is having effects all over his life. He loses his job because he goes on a work retreat and gets pissed up and can't remember potentially sexually assaulting a woman. For the same sort of reason, he ends up losing his wife. His wife kicks him out of his house. He ends up living on his front lawn with all of his, you know, his chair and his vinyl collection, all that sort of stuff, and building up a relationship with a local kid who lives in the district and the woman who's just moved in across the road. And it's a really heartfelt, really moving story. It's a small film. It's a very small, in scale, in scope, in budget, I'm sure. It's a very small, little, independent film. But he is so, so good in it. And not like the kind of usual mugging Will Ferrell that you're used to.
It is really good to see him in a serious role. I thought you were going to say, is it Stranger Than Fiction?
Yeah, that's quite good.
That's good, but this one tops it as well. I totally agree. And the thing is that's good about him is, again, like you said, there's some actors out there, and I know people praise people like Jim Carrey and stuff, but like they're so comedic that I can't ever take them seriously when they do a serious role. But this is the first film that I actually thought to myself, fair play, Will Ferrell can do this. Yeah. And it shocked me because I do associate him so like old school.
Well,
you know, the extreme. He's so extreme.
He literally built a huge reputation as a comedic actor. He was Saturday Night Live, everything, Anchorman, as we all know, old school, and he literally Step Brothers. You can literally list off his comedy CV. And not only is it a good CV, it's a great CV. In fact, you know, to go out and then do something so far removed from your comfort zone and what you're used to.
And so well.
Like Everything Must Go. I mean, that is a small film. I think there's only probably about seven actors in it. Michael Pena is fantastic in that as well. And his sort of interactions, because he's his sponsor, isn't he?
His Alcoholics Anonymous sponsor, yeah.
He's also, I think, in a relationship with his estranged wife or something.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, Michael Pena's brilliant. Will Ferrell's performance in this is so far removed from anything you've seen from him before, really.
And do you know the little kid that he befriends in the neighbourhood? Do you know who that kid is in real life? He is the notorious B.I.G.'s son.
You're joking.
Really?
Yeah.
That's insane.
A little weird little bit of trivia for you there. But it's a lovely film. The relationship between those two, between Will Ferrell and the kid, because the kid's just kind of wandering around on his bike, and you can tell he's a guy that has no real sort of father figure in his life. Yeah. And Will Ferrell's character plays baseball with him and teaches him a bit of responsibility. And I just love all the relationship he has with, I think it's Rebecca Hall, who plays the neighbour across the street. She's wonderful in that film. Yeah. And those two are lovely together. It's a film that I rewatched just, I think I was just flicking the other day, and it happened to be on one of the channels. And it had just started, and I was like, oh, I've got to watch it now. And I'd forgotten how great it is and how much I loved it.
I would kind of like to see a bit more serious roles come from him. Like, we talked about how Steve Carell's now doing them, because he has done a lot of comedies recently that, like, you know, is it like Daddy's Home or stuff like that?
Yeah.
And I'm just like, you need to do something. It's getting a bit too...
Well, that and Get Hard. He's had a run of shit films.
He recently was in a dramatic film called Zoolander 2. Because that wasn't funny.
But I would like to see him kind of do another one.
Oh, me too, absolutely. Yeah.
So my final choice will be Bill Murray in Lost in Translation.
Mm-hmm.
I associate this guy for Ghostbusters, you know, and Groundhog Day. But Lost in Translation was one of the... He's still a bit comedic in it. Like, he's still... You warm to him again, but it's a guy who's going through a midlife crisis. And you just discussed then how great the relationship was in that film. In this film, I think his relationship with Scarlett Johansson's character is beautiful.
Yeah.
And I think... It's a bit of a Marmite film when I talk about Lost in Translation to people. Some people, I just don't get it. I don't understand what's good about it. And maybe there isn't that much good about it, but I bloody love it.
I love it. I think it's an absolutely magnificent film.
I think it's... I will always sit there for 2 hours gladly and watch Lost in Translation. And I think Bill Murray, when you think of the film, it's pretty much him for 90% of the film. And you are absolutely... I'm besotted by his performance in that film. He's great.
I'm besotted by Bill Murray in any film.
Me too. Two of my favourite things that happen in cinema happen in that film. Them singing karaoke in the Japanese karaoke bar, I just think is magnificent. And near the end, when he whispers something in Scarlett Johansson's ear and you don't know what he's said to her. I just love those
it's
two
It's that
moments.
Air of mystery
yeah,
towards
yeah, yeah.
it.
Yeah, I just think they're two of the greatest things in cinema.
Well, that's weird, because my favourite ever thing in cinema is from that film as well. The opening shot of her arse.
Brilliant.
Degrading.
A gentleman as always.
But no, a brilliant Shocking. Film. It's one of those films that, again, you'll watch again and you will forget how much you loved it. And then when you revisit it, it just reminds you of, that's a great film.
And wasn't it directed by Sofia Coppola?
Yes.
What happened to her? Because everything she's done since has been shite.
it's a bit odd because obviously her career started with The Godfather 3.
So she started with a shite career.
And she's just, it's sort of start as you mean to go on. Yeah. There's a bit of a diamond found in Lost in Translation, and then it just goes...
I'm really not into her most recent films, and people rave about them.
She's terrible. Have you seen The Bling Ring?
No, and I don't want to.
Is that about the thieves, isn't it? The teenage thieves? Yeah. Oh, terrible.
The Bling Ring?
Yeah.
I've got to be careful. I'm typing that into Google. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's not of a jazz with your eyes.
Right, go on, then what have you got next?
I'm going for a film called Big Fan. Starring Patton Oswalt.
Never
have you seen
it.
This film? No, it's quite a small film.
I haven't seen it. There's so many people that have told me to watch it.
Absolutely right. Patton Oswalt is an American stand-up comedian. He's not massively big in the UK, which I think is ridiculous. Anyone, you know, if you've got Netflix, I'm sure some of his stand-up shows are on there, so go and watch his stand-up. Eagle-eyed viewers will know him things from like Parks and Recreation, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. He pops up everywhere. In Big Fan, it is sort of a comedy drama. There is definitely a funny edge to it, but he plays a psychotic New York Giants fan who sort of rings into radio talk shows and, you know, gets into arguments with the presenters about how great his team are, and he'll go to every length. And then he ends up running into one of their star players in a bar and getting into a fight, getting his ass kicked by him, which then leads to a Philadelphia Eagles fan on one of these talk shows having a go at him and mocking him in public. So it's about how he tries to get revenge on this Eagles fan, and this guy is like Travis Bickle, Taxi Driver level psychotic. That's what Patton Oswalt is sort of channeling in this film. And it's really dark, like darkly funny, but it's not an out-and-out comedy role that he is known for. And it's a brilliant performance.
I'm going to watch it. I'm sold now. Yeah, that's it. I'm watching it.
I've heard really good things about it. Like, the people who have recommended it, there's never been a bad recommend. No one's ever said, oh, it's not that great.
Yeah.
Everyone always talks about how good it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wish I could talk about it, but yeah. I'm going to watch
it. Yeah, check it out. Especially because you're a New York Giants fan, aren't you, Mark? You've got the jersey.
The tattoos. Yeah, I love them. Obsessed.
And it's not the only good performance he's done as well, dramatically. He was also in Young Adult with Charlize Theron. Have you seen that?
Yes,
film?
I have.
Yeah, I've seen that one.
He's so good in that as well. And that was another one where there was kind of low-level talk about him maybe getting into the awards chatter. It didn't quite happen, but he's another one who is showing every time he gets put in a dramatic role, he can knock it out of the park. So definitely seek out this film, and I say that to all the listeners as well. Big fan.
Awesome. So I guess it's the last one.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to go with Jim Carrey. Now, it's not going to be Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Ooh.
It's going to be The Truman Show.
Of course.
Yeah. Lovely.
The first dramatic role he had.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think this must be what got him Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Because it's the first time he'd really forayed into dramatic acting. And although, there are some comedy elements to this as well, it's very much a dramatic performance from him.
Mm-hmm.
And everything he does is such a gravitas to it. Like, the whole camera is supposed to be focused on him anyway. And the way we kind of see his slow descent from believing the world exists to believing this world doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely phenomenal. It's all down to the actor. It's all down to how he portrays that. Because this is a difficult film to carry. The subject matter is very difficult to kind of believe in that respect. And how you think, how could he not question the world around him? So the way he gets that across and how the shift in where he believes he is to where he knows he is so, so subtle.
Mm.
But so brilliant.
And you're right when you say he carries it. I mean, there are other actors in it, Noah Emmerich, Laura Linney, but he is the focal point of the film for the vast majority of it. And seeing that journey of being this sort of naive guy who believes he lives in this idyllic sort of paradise.
1950s sort of place, isn't it?
So then, you know, starting to see through the facade. And, you know, that scene where he goes out into in the little rowboat and gets to the end of the world, as it were. Like, he realizes it's just painted like sky.
And he finds that
little door. Yeah, that's amazing. It is a brilliant performance.
And it's just how he portrays that is just unbelievable. I mean, there's moments in it where he starts to question everything because he starts seeing, like, lift door, the back of the elevators are gone. And everyone's trying to convince him otherwise. But it's just that slow, the cracks start appearing in his brain. And it's so well done.
I love The Truman Show, but, you know, it's a film I've only watched probably twice because I've got to be in the right frame of mind for it, and it always leaves me a bit depressed. And it's not something I'll just, watch that tonight. It's a bit heavy.
See, now I'm thinking, I want to watch that tonight. That's exactly because I've not seen it in ages.
No.
Maybe 10 years, I don't know.
I had a feeling you might have said Man on the Moon as well, because that's a very good, serious role by him.
He's so good in that.
Really bloody good, but... Yeah. I went to social media and Popcorn Heart, which is a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
She went with Robin Williams in 1 Hour Photo.
Yeah, good choice.
Jim Carrey for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and Maya Rudolph in Away We Go.
Maya Rudolph.
No, he's talking about Mayor Rudolph, the mayor of the North
Christmas,
Pole.
Another guest on the podcast, Rich, has said Will Ferrell in Stranger Than Fiction, Jim Carrey in The Truman Show, and Robin Williams in Insomnia.
He's very good in it, so.
Yeah, I don't like that film, but he is good in it.
Yeah. Jack Lee has said, Robin Williams in 1 Hour Photo, Steve Carell in Foxcatcher. I can't agree with that. And he's gone again.
Simpson, eh?
He's gone again with him in The Big Short, which I'll give him, you're back in the cool club now.
Yeah.
Movie Hotcake have gone with Robin Williams in Good Will Hunt, which seems the most popular choice, Jim Carrey in Eternal Sunshine, and Jamie Foxx in Ray.
That's a very good performance. Yeah.
Stephen White again as Jim Carrey in Eternal. Steve Jobs in... Sorry.
Steve Jobs, what film was he?
Seth Rogen in Steve Jobs.
Yeah, he is
very good.
A great performance.
Yeah.
And Jonas Hill in Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, just for people who don't realise, Mark once pronounced Jonah Hill's name as Jonas about 6 months ago.
Yeah, and we've still not let him
forget. And we're still hopping on the same joke.
Who did Seth Rogen play in Steve Jobs, Mark?
No way. I am not going there at all. And the last one, Travis Bow is Jim Carrey again. I can't be asked to go. Sandler for Rain Over Me.
Yeah.
And Danny McBride, small role, but Up in the Air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is a great performance.
It's a great film as well.
Well, then, the next topic, it's coming to me, isn't it?
Is it?
It is, yeah.
It is.
Ooh.
So this is one that is a top three again. I want to pick a genre that we haven't discussed, and this is one that's got a pool of so many films to choose from. It's ridiculous, but I'm hoping there won't be many crossovers. In the next episode, I want us to come with our top three sports movies.
Wow.
And there is so many.
Yeah, that's good.
So that's it. In 2 weeks' time.
I like that.
we've been to our local View Cinema to see Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice. This is the point where I normally give a synopsis of the film. It's in the title, isn't it?
Look, yeah. Come on, I like it. This is my favourite part when you sum it up in 2 minutes.
Okay, so the film focuses initially on Bruce Wayne dealing with the aftermath of the colossal fight at the end of Man of Steel where Superman and Zod destroyed Metropolis, killing thousands. Batman looks at this as kind of like, it's kind of an analogy for 9/11. This was a destructive event that leveled a city, including Wayne Enterprises' facility in Metropolis. So he sees Superman as a villain or a potential villain. You know, there's a line in the film where he says something like, if there's a 1% chance he could kill us, we have to take it as an absolute certainty. So this is about him waging a war against this god from the sky and about how Superman deals with that. Then we also have the machinations of Lex Luthor behind the scenes as well. So there's a lot going on in what is a very long film. I know we're the only review that counts, but let's be honest about this. The reviews that have been out so far have not been kind to this film.
Really harsh. Lots of 2 out of 10s. It's the same as The Room on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, it's like 40% on Metacritic. Adam, I'm asking you first because this character... Ooh, Batman,
I'm not going first. I'm taking the Ben Deadpool angle on this one. I'm going last.
Fair enough. All right, then. I'll redirect it to Mark. Mark, are those reviews... correct?
No.
Okay.
It is not great, but it's no way shite, and it's not... I think it's totally unfair to be saying it's like 2 stars out of 10. Yeah. I don't think that's justified.
Okay.
At all.
Well, I would say there are a hell of a lot of faults with this film, and we are going to pick through them in detail, I have no doubt. But generally speaking, I enjoyed the hell out of it. I was down with it. I liked it. Adam, you?
I think it was a very accurate representation of Batman, for sure. Mm-hmm. Superman... has been a very different Superman from what we've seen anyway from Man of Steel. So going in, you kind of expected something a bit different from him. There are a lot of faults with the film, but I think that stems from the fact that this works better as a comic book. Zack Snyder is very true to the material.
Yeah,
it's very much a good translation from page to film, mm-hmm. which is something that doesn't necessarily work very well.
Which, you know, which is why Watchmen wasn't as... We all love that film, and people who did comics loved that film, but the people at large didn't love it because it was too faithful, and I think you're right. I think there's a large element of that again. What I would say, I've mentioned other reviews that have come out since. I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist or anything, but I don't want to claim there's some sort of vendetta against Snyder, but some of the reviews I've read, it seems like they've willfully misinterpreted the film or willfully tried to find issues with it where there are none. So, for example, one review that I read, that I won't mention the reviewer or the publication, but they kicked off about the fact that Batman abandons the long-standing rule of not killing, because in this film you see him shoot a load of people. That's true. It was a dream sequence.
Yeah.
So, you know, they in this review I read, they didn't mention it was a dream sequence. They made it just seem like Batman had turned into the Punisher. No, it was a dream. So the people are, they seem to be intentionally trying to have a go at this film.
It's the war. It's afterwards. It's essentially the Superman Prime sort of thing from the Injustice style. He's now ruling the Earth with an iron fist and Batman's taking out his followers.
Yeah.
So a lot's happened in this dream sequence. And then obviously he's awoken by Barry Allen.
Yeah.
Which is a very interesting kind of just throw out there, just in one sort of random, another dream sequence in a way.
Yeah, as you say, at the end of this dream sequence, there's kind of a second dream. You don't know if it's a future premonition or a dream, but you see Barry Allen, the Flash, sort of pop in and warn him and say, you need to find Lois or something like that. There were a few of these. You see a couple of news snippets as well where you see Cyborg effectively being born. You see Aquaman swimming away from some enemies or something. Do you think they tried too hard to shoehorn in Justice League members to say, here we go, the franchise begins now?
I don't think they tried too hard. It was kind of... certain aspects of it were just sort of throwaway scenes. Mm. Of just Wonder Woman checking out these files and seeing them. Mm. I think it's a mistake to try... I've said... The analogy I always use is that if Marvel's here, DC's far behind, and they're trying to catapult themselves to where Marvel are now.
Yeah.
Instead of building the films, they don't want to be a couple of years behind. Mm-hmm. So they're just catapulting themselves to try and establish these characters now, just hoping people understand them.
Which I don't think will work because it's not organic, because with the Avengers, the reason why the Avengers is so great is because we saw all the individual films first and we were looking forward to it. Whereas with this, they've gone, well, here's Batman, Superman, and now Wonder Woman. Here's some video snippets of the other guys, and you'll get Justice League in 2 years. You know, there's been no organic build because, as you say, they're trying to leapfrog Marvel.
But having said that, the Justice League is very much known for having a lot of animosity between each other.
Mm.
So I think just to try and portray them as friends after a few films.
It's not about portraying them as friends. That's not what I'm saying. It's about putting them out in a film where the public cares about the individual members. Mm. We care about the individual members of the Avengers because we've seen them have their individual adventures. We haven't had that. All we've had is DC and Warner Brothers say, here are these guys in little snippets. Get ready for the film starring all of them. Mm. We've not built a love or a care for those characters yet. They're rushing for me.
For me, I thought we'd see more of them. I can't believe we literally saw Aquaman for 10 seconds. The way I was reading about it, I thought he was going to come out of the water and help towards the fight at the end or something. I thought we were going to see a lot more of him.
That's an interesting point, because I thought that was going to happen, and I was praying it didn't.
Yeah.
That would have been too much. That would have been trying too
hard. So I quite like the way we got just a little snippet, and for me that doesn't know all the backstory and read all the comics, it was quite nice. It was like, okay, I recognise him and him, so I'm looking forward to seeing more of him.
So one of the comments I made at the start there was, it's very true to Batman.
Mm.
As far as it goes, what did you guys think of Batfleck?
I thought he was great. Yeah. I thought he was great. Had a world weariness. You know, he mentions a couple of times that he's been doing the Batman gig for 20 years. He's been around the block. You felt that with Affleck. He felt like an older, more mature version of the character than we've seen on screen before. I really dug him, man. I thought he was great. And I'm looking forward to a solo Batman outing.
I liked him. I've read a few things online where people are saying best ever performance. It's a bit early to start saying that. I'm like, calm down, you know, give Bale is, you know, credit, but I really, really enjoyed it, and a lot of people wrote him off when it was announced. And I, like you said, Ben, if he gets behind the camera as well and directs it, my god, it's going to be incredible. But I like the seriousness. I like him. I think as Bruce Wayne, he works perfectly. He's not too arrogant, and he just had that kind of suave about. I liked him. I really did warm to him.
We saw little of Bruce Wayne as the playboy, type character. But I'm not sure if I've said on the podcast before. I know I've definitely spoke to you guys about it before, that how I don't think we've had an accurate representation of someone who can portray both Batman and Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
I think he did. I think he nailed it.
I think he did. And I think the script and the film went out of their way to try and do that, because there's a bit where Bruce manages to figure something out. I forget which bit it is, but he then wants to do something else and he wants to get kitted up as Batman. And Alfred says to him, yeah, but Batman didn't figure out that last thing. Yeah. Bruce Wayne did. And I like the fact that they're trying to show him as this intelligent, you know, he was a detective, supposed to be the world's greatest detective as well as a badass. They're showing that side to him as well, that he doesn't always have to be in the cape punching people to be successful.
He's constantly switched on.
Mm-hmm.
He's constantly doing these sorts of things. And again, it's all about the ensemble characters of the individual comic book characters. I mean, we talked about Jeremy Irons as Alfred, minimalist in this, but fantastic for what he did.
I think they've sort of changed the Alfred character to fit this, because he was sort of a cross between Alfred and Lucius Fox. He was also kind of an engineer, you know, tinkering away on the bat suit and the bat pod, or whatever you want to call it, you know. So I think they've kind of changed. He's not just a butler. Probably it works.
He ain't just bringing cookies and milk and say, here you go.
I'm expecting that's down to the fact that it's 20 years on and maybe Lucius Fox isn't alive anymore.
Yeah, it could be.
So Alfred's kind of had to take on those responsibilities, because, as we know from the comics, Alfred was a former SAS, not only a member, but medic as well. So he always kind of did those sorts of things. They touched upon it in the Dark Knight trilogy as well. But I thought Jeremy Irons did a good job in what he had to do. Again, it was very minimalist. There was a lot in this film of characters that we saw briefly, and then they weren't really necessary.
Mm.
The whole Senate hearing stuff wasn't really... It was more on the this was more of philosophical film. This is more of a philosophical film than a superhero movie.
Yeah, I'm done to death with Senate hearings and courtroom scenes in superhero films. Sick of them. Same, you know, got it in Iron Man and stuff. I just don't want to see those. I don't care. I'm not interested in.
You're going to look forward to Civil War then, because there'll be a lot of legislation going on around there.
I know. Might bring in some like trade negotiations.
It is. It really is, though. Every film, I just leave the fucking courtroom.
Yeah. I mean, there is a certain aspect in this story. It's kind of necessary to have that philosophical side of it. You know, we need to understand that, Bruce Wayne doesn't necessarily take well to Superman.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that line about if there's a not even 1% chance. I don't think that was actually in the film. I think that was actually in the trailer.
No, it was in the film as well.
Was it actually in the film as well?
Yep, it was.
I don't remember actually hearing it. But there's so much going on. I'm not surprised. I thought it did feel a bit rushed throughout the entire thing. I think they were jumping from scene to scene very quickly.
Well, I'll tell you what felt rushed to me, okay? So the whole film, until maybe the final act, is that Batman is against Superman because he believes he's this all-powerful god from the sky that could destroy us all. The thing that changed his mind, he's managed to get hold of some kryptonite, and he's created this kryptonite gas that Superman has inhaled. Batman then womps him wearing his sort of battle suit. Superman is lying on the floor prone. Batman, in his hand, has a spear made of kryptonite ready to end this being, ready to end his life. He's done. The thing that stops him is that they then find out that both of their mums are named Martha. Oh, my mum's named Martha as well. Can we be best friends? And then Batman goes to save Superman's mum Martha and says, oh, I'm your son's friend. You were trying to murder him under half an hour ago, and you're best mates now because you have the same name mum. That, to me, was pathetic.
In all fairness, in superhero films, comics, etc., it happens a lot that you become friends with someone once you've tried to kill them.
Yes, but
usually there's more of a reason to it, not the fact you've got the same mum's name.
I think Lois kind of intervening as well kind of helped that aspect of things.
I thought that was really weak. And
it was shocking.
Poor storytelling to get them from being mortal enemies to bezzy mates.
Next time it's going to be like, oh, you got a red backpack. Me too. I saw it. I was just about to blow your head off, but let's go and get a milkshake. That was poor. That's David. What's his name? Is it David Ayer?
David S. Goyer.
Goyer.
The writer.
Lazy. He is. At times he gets it bad. Sometimes I was sitting there going, oh my lord. But
there is an aspect that they have tried to do too much in one film.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'll give credit for, though, even though what I did like is that the whole background story for Batman was done in the credits. That was great, because it wasn't credits, like 20 minutes and here we go again.
We didn't need to
see his parents shot for 10 minutes. Yeah. Like, bam, done.
It was done very subtly, very, very well done. Yeah. There it was. Onto what I hate.
Was that not what we've just done?
No.
Was that praise we've just been giving?
So fine, but what I hate, Doomsday, Zod becoming Doomsday.
Yeah, so Lex Luthor manages to get the corpse of General Zod. He manages to then use a bit of kryptonite to laser off his fingertips, which allow him access to the crashed Kryptonian ship. He then puts the corpse of Zod with some of his own blood, inexplicably, into this sort of Genesis chamber, and then lo and behold, this creates Doomsday. What?
Who then, when he is born and comes out of his like little egg, he looks up and is just suddenly going absolutely ape, but doesn't go towards him or anyone, just goes ape straight towards Batman. I know what I've got to do. Not like, oh, can you kill him for me? Just straight away. And then the next thing we see is him jump out the building. And it's just too much. It's Michael Bay territory of explosions. And it's
ropey CGI.
15 minutes of fight. Yeah. And at that point, I was like, it's not Batman versus Superman at all now, is it? It should have been Batman and Superman versus Zod. That should be the title of this film.
You'd have given it away a little bit.
But it was too much. You know, I was expecting this massive fight between Batman and Superman. And that was quite shortened.
It was good. The actual physical fight the two of them had was really compelling, actually. But it wasn't long enough.
And it did remind me that, to be fair to Snyder, we rip him a lot, but he can direct a fight scene very well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing I think Christopher Nolan felt short on in the Batman films. I don't like criticising him, but this is how to do a fight. It looked real.
Yeah.
Apart from the 25-minute CGI fest after that.
I kind of severely hated the fact that Zod became Doomsday.
Mm-hmm. You are looking quite angry.
You got annoyed, actually.
We should film this.
I just didn't understand it. I didn't understand where they were coming from. I didn't understand what was going on. And like you say, he just inexplicably cuts his hand, pours some blood in.
Why would Luther's blood on Zod's face then create Doomsday?
Is it even the fact that the ship even says, nope, this has been banned from...
Yeah, don't do it.
And he's like, oh no, override. Okay, fine, no worries.
I didn't get that. Just say oh, it's all right.
Where's the council? The council are dead. Well, I'm the only authority. Yeah. No, you're not.
It's one of those films where as soon as a stupid gaping plot hole like that happens, a big explosion happens to misdirect you. You know, it's a bit of shiny tinfoil to turn your mind away.
And that frustrated me no end. And then
the only reason why they've ended up turning Zod into Doomsday is so that then Doomsday is Kryptonian and therefore can die with kryptonite. That's the only reason why they've kept that logic in, just because there's some kryptonite knocking about.
But it was just ill thought out.
What did you think of Luther?
I was just about to say those exact words. Mm-hmm. I liked him. I think he's again, I've been reading people saying he's not right, he's miscast, he's a little bit too comical for me. I've not read the comics, but he was a bit like, he's getting on Joker's territory of like,
cackling.
And I was like, you've been a little bit annoying, but I liked him. I thought he did well.
Yeah, I didn't like him at all.
Really?
When they cast Jesse Eisenberg as Luther, everyone was saying it's miscast, it's terrible. And I was like, no, let's wait. Let's see the film first. I'm with him now. I thought he was completely wrong for it. But I think they might have tried to use a little loophole here. if memory serves, and maybe this is only true of Smallville, but in Smallville, I'm sure Lex Luthor's dad was Lionel Luthor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that true of the comics as well, Adam? I don't know if you know off the top.
Yeah, Lionel Luthor.
In this film, Lex says, when someone says, oh, you know, you hear Luthor Corp, and he went, no, the Lex in Luthor Corp was my father. So they're effectively saying he's Lex Luthor Jr. He refers to the fact that his dad was Lex Luthor. Mm. So I don't think he is the Lex that we know. I think he is Lex Luthor's son, which gives them a bit more dramatic license for him to be totally different from the Lex we know. That, I think, is their little loophole there.
It could potentially. There was a bit of a throwaway line, wasn't it?
Yeah.
My personal thoughts on Eisenberg were he was fine to start with, mm-hmm. and then he got very annoying very quickly.
Yeah.
Here's the thing is the charming comedic aspects of him was fine as that public persona.
Yeah.
And then as the film went on, he started to get slightly more maniacal. Mm-hmm. It didn't work. He kept the comedy aspects of it. And if you're going to get maniacal, get maniacal.
Yeah.
You're not the Joker. You never will be.
He was just, for me, he was just doing his Eisenberg character, but on amphetamines. He was just a jacked up Zuckerberg character, I should say. He was just social network all over again, but just hyped up.
I mean, my issue with the film is the amount of foreshadowing.
Mm.
That's all it was. It was just, again, it was another, let's build to Justice League.
It was a 3-hour trailer for the next film.
Yeah. And that is frustrating beyond belief, because you could have held a lot of this back.
Yeah, but let's bring it out of that spiral of negativity. One of the things that's going to lead to the next Justice League film and her own film is Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
What did we think to her?
I thought she was fantastic.
Brilliant.
Me too.
One of the best things about it.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Yeah. My only issue with her is Gal Gadot is Israeli or something. I'm not sure where she's from, but she has a thick accent. So some of her lines got kind of swallowed up by her accent. Mm. She doesn't have great clarity. But other than that, I thought she looked the part. I thought she was a badass. When she turns up in that final boss battle, just out of nowhere, I thought she was cool as hell.
Yeah.
One of the things I liked about it is because this film is so dark and relentlessly grim, and neither Batman nor Superman look like they're having a good time. She did. When she was fighting Doomsday, she was smiling. She's rushing in with her sword in the air with a big smirk on her face. And she's a warrior. And loving it.
Yeah, this is it. It seemed like she was, you know, she's battle hardened by this point as well. She had mentions to Batman that she turned her back on mankind.
Yeah.
Because of the wars they waged in the 1900s. And now she's back in the battle and she's absolutely loving it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to have such a dominating female presence in a superhero movie.
Well, it's refreshing because the Marvel universe has done piss poorly in that respect.
They started out well with Black Widow.
Yeah.
And then after Age of Ultron, it just kind of went.
Yeah, but even she, you know, I always think back to that scene in the first Avengers where they're in the middle of New York and they're all sort of back-to-back watching all the aliens come in. And you've got the Hulk, who's this beast, and you've got Thor with his hammer, and Iron Man's got his, you know, his blasters on his suit. And there is Black Widow with the smallest gun you've ever seen. You're like, you're outmatched here. They're not even trying to give her any sort of grandeur. Mm. So I'm hoping they're going to get better at that. Now we've got the Wasp in the MCU as well. It's getting bigger, it's getting better. But I think I like the fact that with this, do they call it the DCEU, the DC Extended Universe? Copy much. So I like the fact that they are starting out with a strong female character. I'm looking forward to her.
One of the things that really interests me about it is she seemed like more of a threat to Doomsday than anything else. Mm. She was the one that was like hacking and slashing at him.
Chopping limbs off, yeah.
And Doomsday, a lot was made about Doomsday when he first appeared in the trailer and how he looked. And he didn't look like Doomsday. What did you guys think of that? Because my prediction was pretty much exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. Every time he got hurt or slashed or cut, the Crystalis would appear on his body.
Yeah.
And I thought that was done very well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing is, when we first saw him, we only saw him on the trailer, didn't we, at the very end, and he looked like one of the Turtles.
Yeah.
It's true. But I liked it when he was first created. I thought he looked really good, because he wasn't damaged at all and looked really cool. And then we saw him getting battered. I loved it. I was unfair on him, actually, because I said he looked terrible before, and I'll take it back. I thought he looked really good.
My issue is that he shouldn't have been in the trailer.
Yeah,
that would have been awesome.
That should have been a surprise they kept, because they could have sold the film on literally being Batman versus Superman. With two people with completely different backgrounds. One's a human, the other's an alien, all powerful. What will happen? That's a selling point enough. You know, fanboys like us, Christ, all our lives of reading comics and what, especially me and you, Adam, have longed to see this battle.
Yeah.
Film fans, even if you're not a comic book fan, because there's been so many Superman films, so many Batman films, people have longed to see these two together. Mm. That would have sold it. They didn't then need to jam Doomsday into the trailer. Save that for the film itself. Make that a surprise.
It was interesting to see that they kind of took the license from the comics with regards to all the traps he set up for Superman as well. Yeah. The sonic waves and. But I didn't really understand it because he hadn't really done any research on.
No.
So he didn't realize he had super hearing at the time.
No, that's true. I think he was just trying shit.
Yeah.
Just see what works.
Trial and error.
He went, oh, none of this works. Let's just use the kryptonite then.
Well, I guess we're going to have to use the kryptonite. Yeah. But it's just, yeah, it was a bit odd in that respect. But yeah, save Doomsday for the film itself. You're gonna love it when it comes on screen.
And here's one for you then, because you and I are comic book readers, Adam. This has been spoiler filled as it is, but massive spoiler alert: Superman dies at the end. Now, because we're comic book geeks, we know, Adam, that Doomsday historically in the books kills Superman. We knew this, so we knew this was a fair chance of happening. Mark, I presume you didn't know that Doomsday was a character in the books that killed Superman. So, did you see that coming, or how did you feel that played out?
I had no idea. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, "What? Like, is he going to come out? Is his fist going to come through the coffin? Or is he going to not be dead? Like, that can't be it."
Yeah.
And then we saw the funeral scene, and then we saw it kind of ending. And then that's one thing I want to say now, because I will forget. It ended about 8 times. It really pissed me off, ending. I was like, here it is. It's the end now. Batman's saying to Lois, oh, we'll fight and get revenge, and it should have ended. Then there was another scene.
It was like a wrestling match.
It was so annoying.
False finishes.
Literally. Yeah. I was like,
The weird thing of that was the continuity of it as well. Because it had Bruce Wayne and Diana Prince watching over Clark Kent's grave while Lois Lane was kind of putting soil in. And they were having a little chat about how they're going to have to fight. He goes, just a feeling.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to Lex in a prison cell with Batman appearing in front of him.
Yeah.
And it's like, but he's at the funeral.
Yeah.
And then you cut back and you see him walking
away
from
the
grave.
Yeah, then you cut back and you see him at the funeral again.
Yeah, the chronology.
Who's Batman
is
then?
And then there was something, I'm sure there was another thing. I was just like, just end.
Yeah.
But
and then, of course, there was a very subtle shot of the dirt rising off the coffin at the end to say, he's not dead, he'll be back in Justice League in 2 years' time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you've seen the Death of Superman Lives, fantastic documentary about the Superman Lives film that never happened, starring Nicolas Cage. And they mentioned in that documentary about how Doomsday was the one who killed Superman, and this the film was going to be about the revival of Superman. So we're obviously going to get to see that on screen now, this revival of Superman again coming up. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, I think it's going to be a really tedious 20 minutes of the next film. The first 20 minutes of Justice League will be him coming back to life, or, you know, it'll be people mourning and then him coming back to life. It's just too predictable. Mm. We know that's what's going to happen.
Would you prefer they kept him out of part one?
I prefer he was just dead. Because, to be honest, I'm bored of Henry Cavill, because the guy's charmless, which simply isn't true. He's charmless in this role, because I think we've all seen The Man from U.N.C.L.E. now, haven't we?
Yeah.
And he's so charming and so fun in that, and I just wish he'd bring an ounce of that to Clark Kent and Superman, because he brings none of it. He's so drab, and I think that's maybe my biggest fault with this film, is that the whole Batman-Superman thing is one represents the light, Superman, one represents the dark, Batman. But this film, it's just all dark all the time. Superman has nothing about him. There's no life or light in him. It's just drab, grim darkness.
This incarnation of Superman they put on screen since Man of Steel has been more alien than human.
Yeah.
And Superman was always kind of the character who...
Well, he's a Kansas farm boy, isn't he?
Yeah, he was all American. Yeah. And that's why the bagpipes just got me in a funeral as well. Why were the bagpipes? He's all American.
They have that at like military and police funerals.
Yeah, but this was at Clark's funeral. There were people in kilts.
What? Kansas.
Oh, yeah, that really strong Scottish contingent in Kansas.
When you think we just went to see Batman versus Superman, I can't remember much about Superman. He was on screen now and then. He didn't deliver any dialogue apart from telling him his dad he misses his dad, which didn't even really look sincere.
Yeah.
And every time he was filmed, it just, like you said, he was just sort of looking at the camera and giving like a, I'm going to defeat you. And there was nothing. Mm. It was just boring.
The only bit of Superman in that film I really liked was the Batman dream sequence where, you know, the Superman followers have taken over and are beating up.
And he just
Batman
kills
and
four people.
He kills them with his heat vision and then rips the mask off Batman. That was the best part of him. And it was a dream sequence. Didn't really happen.
Get rid. Let him. Just don't get him to, you know, come back alive. Leave him.
Bring back Brandon Routh.
Doing a fantastic
Nicolas
job
Cage.
As Ray Palmer.
Get Nicolas Cage in.
But it is interesting when you look at the incarnation of Superman they've created, because Superman, by definition, a lot of people find quite dull.
Mm.
And this is even more dull.
Yeah.
Like, he is even more dull in this.
Yeah.
Like, they've given him literally no personality whatsoever.
I have never been a fan of the Superman character in principle, because he is dull, because he's an all-powerful space alien. That's not interesting to me. Batman is one of the most interesting characters, because he's a real human with real issues who has, you know, used his wealth to become what he is. Superman is just a god from space. So he is boring, innately boring. And as you say, they've made it worse, because at least in the other films, other representation of him, he was charming, yeah. had a bit of spark to him. Whereas in this, he is so dull. And I'm looking at Lois and thinking, you could do better, love. I know he's Superman, but you could do better.
Get yourself on Tinder, you know. Don't stick around here. You can do much better for yourself.
Maybe, yes, she swipes right on Batman. And that's why this whole fight happens.
I'll definitely swipe right on Wonder Woman. I am in love a little bit. Mm-hmm. I really am.
Always has to bring it down to his base.
It's always sex objects, isn't it?
I won't know if you say it like that. I just thought she was stunning.
The whole feminism thing passed him by entirely, didn't it?
I thought she was a fantastic warrior who earned her right to fight.
Yeah.
Okay, I agree. So let's just talk about the direction, because it was an absolute CGI fest. At times, I thought the CGI was brilliant.
Yeah.
When he went up to space and was fighting there, I thought it looked great. It was like, wow, this looks really good. At times, I thought it looked dreadful.
I don't think the quality of the CGI was bad. I think it was okay. I think it was just because the final act takes place in darkness. It's at night, and there's explosions and buildings falling and four different people smashing into each other. There was too much happening. You couldn't really see what was going on at times. So it wasn't that the CGI was bad. It just wasn't very focused. You just didn't really know what was happening. The direction could have been better there.
I think it was vintage Schneider. It was a visual feast for the eyes, and it looked great for what it was. There were some fantastic comic book panel shots like he always does. There was some wonderful direction in that regards, but Some of it was just a bit too much.
Yeah.
And then this is a criticism he gets levelled at him quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Sometimes less is more, but
he'll never listen to that. Yeah. He's never, ever going to change.
So, you know, I've got no issue with him if he wants to go out and do that and stuff. And Sucker Punch isn't a good film, but visually it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And
chewing gum for the eyes.
Yeah.
No thanks.
But that's exactly what goes on with Snyder films. We all know what they're like. We know what we're getting ourselves into when we go and watch them. It's going to be a visual spectacle.
Yeah, and I think the direction was generally good. I think there was too much going on in the final act. I think the first couple of acts were really well directed, actually. I think they looked great.
The opening was stunning. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the opening credits. And I do genuinely now look forward to owning them both and watching them back to back. And I think it will work really well.
Yeah, I mean, I rewatched Man of Steel this past week. And they do flow beautifully into one another. Yeah,
there's a great, obviously the great moment at the start when it starts off basically with the introduction of Bruce Wayne and his parents dying, and that leads into Metropolis sort of 18 months prior.
Yeah,
and it shows Bruce arriving during the
I love that
terraforming devices hitting.
Yeah,
Metropolis.
Yeah, that's so
it's
good,
brilliant,
and it's just a brilliant opening sequence. As you know, he sees his Wayne financial collapse, and
it's great,
and he really kind of seals. Why, and to show you why in 5 minutes was really well, good storytelling.
Do you know what I think is really efficient storytelling as well? The fact that they've set Metropolis and Gotham as being just as if there's just a bit of water. It's basically New York and New Jersey. That's all that's separating the two of them, which I think is smart in terms of building that world, keep them close.
It does, yeah. It is. You're right. I'm. There were moments in this film where I was just dreading what was going to happen as well. Because after the Doomsday thing, I was thinking, oh God, anything's going to happen now. And when Superman was in space after the nuclear bomb had gone off and he was just sort of getting healed by the sun, I was just sitting there thinking, please don't bring Green Lantern. Please don't bring Green Lantern. Please don't bring... And this is the problem, because I found myself doing it too much. There was too much of me
panic.
Thinking, please don't do this, please don't do that, please don't do this, please. And one of them was the Flash. I was half expecting, at the end of this film,
yeah.
to have Doomsday standing there with Superman, Batman, Aquaman, Flash, Green Lantern, Cyborg and everyone just there fighting him. And I think I'd have walked out.
Well, at least it's a relief they didn't.
It is.
Credit.
I wish they would have cut the scene of the Flash, whether it was a premonition or not. I didn't like that. It was too much. They didn't need it. And also, I didn't like his costume. He looked like he had a sort of metallic Flash. He looked a bit like the Iron Man suit.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just because I love the Flash TV show and I think the costume in that is spot on.
It looked very sort of... The interesting thing about that costume is it looked very similar to his one from Injustice. The rogue, the Flash who works with Superman.
Yeah.
So I'm curious as to whether this premonition is something that they're going to lead into.
Mm-hmm. Shall we score it?
Wow, we've been quite. I've just listened back. We've been a lot of praise.
Yeah.
We started off with and we've been quite.
There's a lot to like about the film. There's a lot of faults with it, and there's a lot to like as well. As you said earlier, the reviews have been
really harsh,
really critical, really harsh. And to be honest, I don't see it as any more than above average. It's not great, but it's not bad.
Yeah, I would agree. So for me, it's a 7.
Yeah,
I'm going to go right there. There with you. Yeah, I'm 7. There at 7 as well.
Straight 7s.
Prize giveaway time. On the last episode, we had a competition to win a Huntsman Winter's War bundle, which consisted of a hoodie, a bag, a nice pillow, a notebook, and a ring.
Sorry, guys and girls, you couldn't win Chris Hemsworth.
We only had one of these to give away, but I've actually upped it, and I spoke to Universal, and they've given us 3.
Ooh.
So the winners are Philip Rogers on Facebook, Ruth Jones on Facebook, and Asher Elfing on Facebook. Now, if I pronounce the names wrong, you will get contacted by us and you will get your prize. So.
Ruth Jones.
James Corden's comedy writing partner.
Yeah.
She said she really wanted the pillow. So, yeah,
fair.
You know.
That's fair.
So thanks very much. And all those guys will be receiving those soon. Now, on this episode, I thought it'd be good to get some prizes for Batman versus Superman.
Makes sense.
It does make sense.
Synergy.
Perfect. So thanks to Warner Brothers this time, we have got 2 key tags, a metal...
What's a key tag?
It's what you put your keys on. That's the thing
a
now.
Key ring?
Yeah, it's called key tag now. You're not one of the cool kids.
Kids these days.
Metal Earth,
all key tags are knife crime.
A Metal Earth Batmobile, a wallet, a Funko Pop Nightmare Batman and Superman limited edition set, a journal, a beanie, 2 jumpers, an umbrella, gloves, t-shirts... And a backpack.
Have we got to pay for postage for this?
But I also think it should be called a bat pack. Do you like that?
No.
Ridiculous.
So we've got one of these to give away because it's a hell of a bundle. Yeah. And lucky we haven't got to pay postage, so the box is going to be absolutely huge. But this is stuff you can't buy. Mm-hmm. You can't just go into any comic shop and buy this sort of stuff. So to win this prize, all you're going to have to do is tell us who directed Batman versus Superman. You can do this on our Facebook channel, on our Instagram, on our Facebook page, but the best way to do it is go on skipthem.co.uk and all the links are there. And I'll announce the winner of this very, very, very rare exclusive Batman versus Superman prize in 2 weeks' time.
I can already hear Mark. He's literally chomping at the bit. Mm-hmm. He wants to say what his film is. It's Skip Back Time. It's the '80s. It's 1988. He literally wants to go. I can see it. So I'm not going to send to him first.
Yeah.
Ben, what is your best film from 1988?
Well, before I say, this is the one where last week I predicted that we might all have the same one. I think that's still a possibility. I'm pretty damn sure you and I, Adam, will have the same one, but Mark might have thrown in a swerve, and I know what his other choice would be. So I'm going to go with Die Hard, because it is not only the greatest film of 1988, it is arguably the greatest film of the 80s, arguably the greatest film of any decade ever, because it's just that damn
good. And the best Christmas film ever.
Of course, yeah. Just Bruce Willis, shoeless, broken glass in his feet, climbing Nakatomi Plaza, blowing Germans away, unreal. It doesn't get better than that for me. It's pure popcorn action fun. Some of the best one-liners in film. Possibly the greatest villain, Hans Gruber.
Yeah,
Alan Rickman, RIP. It's just got it all. There is nothing about that film I don't love. It is one of my... we have our feature, The Rewatch, which is a bit of a misnomer because often it's films we've never seen. This really is the rewatch for me because... I don't know how many times I've seen Die Hard. It's got to be double figures. I mean, it's definitely double figures. It's probably in the 20s, I would
say. Every Christmas, I bet you watch it.
Oh, hell yeah. You know, other people will be watching, you know.
Who doesn't at Christmas? I mean, I watch
Santa Claus the movie and It's a Wonderful Life.
Exactly, yeah.
Whatever.
And I'd rather be dead. I'm watching Die Hard and Elf.
And Gremlins.
It is one of the single greatest films that has ever been.
And now I'm ready for Adam to go, I totally agree, yep, and just say...
I've not got that.
Has he picked a film he's
I'm
in?
I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
What's he got with?
What have you got?
I'll give you a hint, Ben.
Yeah.
Steer Act 3!
The Naked Gun.
I looked at it and I was really torn between a few... There's about 3 or 4 films this time around that I wasn't sure about. And I thought... well, which one do I watch the most?
Yeah.
And it's that one. It's The Naked Gun from The Files of Police Squad. The first in the Naked Gun series. Leslie Nielsen is an absolute genius. This is, for me, one of the best comedy films ever made.
No doubt.
It is so funny. OJ Simpson's in it, unfortunately.
I love his afro, though. It's amazing. But
everything about this film is just, it's gag after gag after gag.
Yeah.
And all of them land.
Oh, big time. The whole, you know, you've just said strike three there. The whole scene that takes place at the baseball game is one of the single funniest things ever. And as you well know, your brother John, he and I went out to New York and we went to a New York Yankees game and we must have pissed off all the Yankees fans because we're just quoting Frank Drebin.
I bet all of them were like, they're British.
It's just, oh, no doubt. We were sort of dancing down Fifth Avenue doing the little strike dance.
Grabbing anyone in a wheelchair and just throwing them down.
We did like the splits and punching the bat boy as well. But this is just one of the films where every gag lands, and some of them build as well, like the Enrico Palazzo gag.
Yeah.
Like literally, he comes out, he pretends to be this opera singer trying to sing the national anthem. He can't do it, he gets booed off. But later on, after he saves the Queen from being assassinated, he takes his mask off and just hears someone in the crowd go, "Hey, it's Enrico Palazzo!"
It is an amazing film.
I've seen this film more times than I could probably count.
And it never gets old. It never gets old. Tarnishes in any way. It's just as good every single time.
So I had to choose it.
Naked Gun and Airplanes, the films that you'll always... You've seen the joke 50 times.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I spit my drink when I'm watching it. Like, I can't believe I'm laughing at it again. But it just works. And it works for a sequel as well.
Do you know what joke cracks me up in Airplane? I can't remember if it's Leslie Nielsen's character or the pilot. I think it's the pilot. And the little lad, is it Timmy or something, comes into the cockpit. And he turns to him and says, "Have you ever seen a grown man naked?"
Yeah, it's
hilarious. Like, at the time, because pedos didn't exist then, apparently. But it's just now that you couldn't get that joke in a film.
He asked him like a series of questions. Ever been in their cockpit before?
You just wouldn't get away with it now. No. They did exist, I think, but social media didn't kind of find them.
Yeah. Hold on, before you pick yours, Mark. So, I was thinking we might all go for Die Hard, but as I said, I think Mark might throw a curveball. So, permit me to guess. Can I guess what I think you have gone for?
Yes, go for it.
Big.
Of course.
Yeah.
But it was a close one, and it really was. It's like... Big, I've talked about on this podcast too much. It is my most watched film in my entire life because I watched it growing up. But Die Hard is absolutely awesome, and I think every Christmas I can't not watch it. It's like a religious film to watch. It's the action film.
Yeah.
But I can't leave Big. I just can't.
Yeah.
Tom Hanks's best performance for me. Everything about that film's amazing, and it's nostalgic reasons. I watched it as a kid. I bought it on DVD. I then bought it on Blu-ray. I've got a stupid Blu-ray that plays the piano theme when you open it up. We went to New York.
Well, this is it. On a different visit to New York, we went to the toy store and danced on the piano, didn't we?
You pushed in front of a lot of kids, didn't you, first?
There was an actual queue of children waiting to go on this, and because we wanted a photo op and couldn't be asked to wait, Mark just sort of elbowed his way through these kids, hopped over the rope, stood on the piano so we could snap off a couple of photos,
and ran off.
And then we legged it.
Yeah, I literally was in there 1 minute, but I got the photo I needed. And I've read the other day it's not there anymore.
It's closed down. When John and I were there last, it's a derelict building now.
That's depressing. But for me, Big is brilliant, and I think Tom Hanks that's one of his earliest films, and it's just brilliant. Like, I've always wanted to find Zoltar, and not now, make a wish that I'm older, because that would be depressing.
Like, end up at like 65 shitting yourself.
Yeah, find that machine again. But it's just a great film, and everything about it is great. And when I go to New York again, New York special, I'm going to go and visit everywhere off that film, because it's just stunning.
It is absolutely an absolutely stunning brilliant film, yeah.
And we're not being sponsored now by the New York Travel Board.
But if you want to sponsor us, please do. And we'd all love to go again.
Doing a live episode in New York.
You know where I think it's great? New York.
Yeah.
And Strongbow Dark Fruits.
Strongbow Dark Fruits. Do you know what I love as well about Big is that Hanks was nominated for Best Actor?
That's amazing.
I forget that. I always forget. You know, I think of him being nominated for Philadelphia and Forrest Gump, you know, the god-awful films he did. But I forget that he was nominated for this as well, because I think of this as sort of just a fun 80s comedy.
Yeah.
But he was nominated for better. Rightly so, he is fantastic.
Josh Baskin, mate. That's the one.
Yeah.
He's an absolute legend. So I think the worst thing about, you started this section with, you know, Mark is sitting here trembling, ready to talk. It is a little bit depressing, because as each episode goes, it's another one ticked off the 80s, which so we have to eventually say goodbye.
We've been counting down to the 80s, and now we're just watching them go by.
Yeah, and what I did like is in the 90s, we were all saying, oh, I've had my choice locked in. You know, this is getting to the point where there's two or three that, you know, people can't quite work out what it's going to be.
You.
Oh, 18. We'll go to social media and you'll realise just how, you know, that actually is true. Ben Sinclair McDonald, Crocodile Dundee 2. And he's put, his reason is because it's got a character called Rad in it.
Brilliant.
If you can sell it, you know, that's great. David Tate has put Rain Man.
Yeah.
Which is a great, great film. Mm-hmm. The winner of the projector, I'm going to get it right now, Franny Elizabeth. I got it right. Coming to America.
Yeah.
What a great film.
Great film.
And she also wanted to give a shout out to your film, Twins.
Franny is also one of our best tweeters, I would say.
She's always doing like office gifts and stuff like that, so keep them coming. Mm-hmm. Tim Thompson has also put Coming to America. Film Carnage has put Beetlejuice.
Tremendous film.
What a film. And would want to give a runner-up to A Fish Called Wanda, which I've only seen once.
That's a great film. John Cleese.
Really good film.
Joe Mayers has put A Solid Year, but it's got to be John Carpenter's They Live.
Awesome. Oh, great.
Do you know how hard that is, leaving that off? Mm-hmm. Ken Mayer has put Moonwalker. The smooth criminal section was my favourite part. Mm-hmm. See, it's a bit tarnished now. I can't really watch that film. And finally, at Fireball Darren, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? What a great film.
So good.
That was the first one that kind of mixed the whole film with animation as well, and it worked.
I like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but the problem is I always get mistaken for Bob Hoskins.
It's an easy mistake.
Exactly.
So, it really is.
You're like, I'm Danny DeVito, I'm not Bob Hoskins.
So that's a great, great year, I think. We agree. And next time it's 1987.
Mm-hmm. Bet you can't wait. Got a bit of a confession to make here. Now, I picked this rewatch last week, Spirited Away, because I was not fully confident that we'd enjoy Batman versus Superman.
Right, right, yeah.
And wanted something that I knew we'd all enjoy to talk about on the podcast.
Makes sense.
It just seemed like it would be the best idea, especially given the fact that this is Miyazaki and Spirited Away, and how can you not love this film?
Next time, just bring more Strongbow.
It's probably a good
plan. You know what I mean? That's a backup plan.
Yeah. In all fairness, if Strongbow Dark Fruit sent us some...
Yeah, we could drink it in New York.
Yeah.
it'd be great. We'd never go thirsty again.
Nope.
So, back to the rewatch.
Back to the rewatch. So, I chose Spirited Away, and this is a absolutely beautiful tale of a young girl whose parents get sidetracked as they're taking her to a new sort of school, new town. And they end up in this sort of fantasy world of the spirits, where sort of gods and spirits go to this bathhouse to relax when they're finished doing their work. And it's really difficult film to describe.
It is difficult, yeah. Like her parents get turned into pigs,
yeah.
And then she ends up having to work at this bathhouse and and then, you know, revive her parents and all this. It's
But it's run by the evil witch called Yubaba.
Mm-hmm.
Who is a sorceress who will turn any humans into animals should they wrong her. So Haku, who is the boy who helps Chihiro, or Sen, as she also gets known, after signing a contract, helps her sort of find work in the bathhouse and sort of survive for a bit before disappearing. But it's an interesting tale.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I presumably you've both seen this before anyway.
Many times.
As soon as we've both put it in our top animated films of all time, then
I've never seen it. So, yeah. I was guessed.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't surprise me. But yeah, so, I mean, overlying thoughts, I mean, we've spoke about it before, but beautiful film.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
That's the word, isn't it?
What I want to throw out first of all is, did you watch the original Japanese audio with English subtitles, or did you watch the English dub?
I will never ever watch this English dub.
Okay, Adam?
I watched the Japanese with English dub.
Now, as a big fan of anime, my rule, generally speaking, is I will always watch the original Japanese and watch with the subtitles. That's how I prefer to do it. My only exception to that is Studio Ghibli films, because they make a concerted effort to have very good English dubs. A lot of English dubs of other anime films, the audio won't match the lips. It won't sync up with the lips. It'll look terrible. But Ghibli don't do that, and especially this film. Because it was so big in Japan, it was actually Pixar head honcho John Lasseter who oversaw the English dub for this. And it's the one, pretty much the one anime film that I prefer the English dub. The English voice work is so good. So if you haven't seen the if you've only seen the Japanese,
I have seen it.
The English dub.
Wow. The John Ratzenberger is obviously the assistant.
Yeah, the old Pixar connection. Yeah. So it is genuinely, both are brilliant, but it's one where I can wholeheartedly recommend the English dub.
Yeah, it's odd for me because I have no issue with the English dub. I think it's fantastic. And like with all Ghibli films, like you've just said, they generally make a concerted effort to make sure it's fine. But it's a thing for me. I always watch any anime in the original language with the subtitles. I think one of the things that kind of gets me is because I used to watch a lot of anime as a kid from Cartoon Network, Toonami, dubs, like poor dubs. Mm-hmm. A lot of the translation got lost.
Yeah.
You found that these companies like Cartoon Network didn't care what the original thing was said. They changed it to suit whatever script they wanted.
Yeah.
So I got this hideous distrust of any sort of dub. So I always watch in Japanese now with subtitles.
Yeah, I get it completely. And I do the same with anything else other than Ghibli. Yeah. Especially because they tend to go out their way to get good voice actors. So you say you've got, John Ratzenberger. Yeah. Other Ghibli films have had people like Christian Bale. I think he's in Princess Mononoke.
Wow.
I think Michael Keaton might even be in like Porco Rosso. They have really big, decent names.
I'm going to start watching them all again now with the actual English dub.
Yeah.
Wow. I think the word you've used, and to hear my thoughts on this film, I can't not use beautiful. It's like it's just got to be said. Yep. We can talk about other. It's such a gorgeous film. The animation is flawless in every aspect, and it's so colourful and so well done that you just kind of get lost in it. So you'll put it on and you sit there and you start the film and you don't look away for 2 hours. It's not one you'd want to pause and go and get a drink, unless you really need a wee or something. But you're totally just drawn into this. And because so much random stuff is going on, that it starts pretty normal. If you started and they're like, they're going along in the car and then they pull over and they start walking, you think, oh, this is quite normal. It's only when that moment they turn into pigs and then it all goes like, have I had some acid? Like, what's in this drink I'm drinking? Like, this has suddenly gone crazy. And it gets more and more crazy. And to try and sum up this film, Adam, I think you've done really well, because I would not know where to start. The amount of characters and different creatures that come into it and everything, it's absolutely insane.
I think you using a sort of drug analogy there is totally right, because it is so trippy and weird. And as we say, they're in the spirit world, and there are all these different spirits who are just so bizarre looking, but brilliant, so beautiful and crazy and weird. Like, my favourite character in the whole film is No Face.
No Face is great.
He's more of a monster than a spirit, I think they say, and he sort of eats people and gets fatter and weirder and changes shape and all this sort of stuff, but he's got this kind of kabuki mask on while he does it. Absolutely brilliant. And then you've got there's a radish spirit, they call one of the guys who's got these big floppy tits. Just walking around with a little hat on.
But it's such a weird character, but you don't question it. You just go along with it. Okay, he's got his tits out and his hat on the side.
The best way I've ever heard described as far as characters go is a Japanese version of Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland.
It's very like that. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what Chihiro has done. She's gone through the looking glass or whatever,
And it's phenomenal to watch and witness, because, like I said, not only is the animation just nailed on perfect, every single creature design is well thought out.
Yeah, and so different.
Yeah.
There's no, repetition.
It's like, and there's some of the themes they deal with as well. I mean, they have the river god that they originally think is like a sludge demon.
Yeah.
And you find out it's actually a polluted river.
Yeah.
So the river god is all polluted. It's just, there's so many subtle moments in this.
Yeah.
And it's so fantastic.
Because that is a fairly sort of subtle ecological message, that she cleans it up. It's very like Birdemic.
I was just about to say, it's a lot like Birdemic, the more you think about it. Beautiful to look at, thoughts gone into it. Yeah.
The biggest theme for me is, it's pretty standard in the sense that it's a coming-of-age tale for Chihiro. Chihiro, when she first arrives at this, it's a disused theme park in the real world, but this bathhouse in the spirit world, she won't walk through the archway. She's grabbing onto her mum's arm and is terrified. Yeah. And she's this scared little girl at the start of the film. By the end of it, she's this confident young woman who's an absolute badass, completely fearless. Mm. And you see how she grows through this film. It's brilliantly done.
even wanting to trick No Face into eating the herbal to make him throw up everything. Yeah. And going off on an adventure by herself, she's not got any qualms with getting on the train and going to Zen
Barbers. Exactly, whereas before, at the start of the film, she wouldn't walk through a tunnel. You know, she's really come of age. It's fantastic.
What's really opened up my eyes for this one is when we do the rewatch and stuff, I always try and find a bit of music that's from the actual film. You'll hear this on all the episodes. This is the first one where I couldn't really easily choose a track. Every song from this film for the score is absolutely amazing. Mm. And it's the first one where I've been literally probably taking 10 hours to choose. Mm. Every song is amazing, and you don't realise how important and
it's that detail, though, isn't it?
It really is, and it makes every scene beautifully. And if you've got iTunes or whatever at home, Spotify, listen to this album in its entirety because it's absolutely gorgeous, and it's as good as the animation for what it gives to the film.
It is. It adds so much depth to it.
What another thing was is I watched this, I think, at university, and I remember people talking about it. It was a bit like, you know, when the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was the first major martial arts film that everyone started talking about. This was the first one that everyone started talking about animation in a massive, massive way. And it's a bit addictive, because once you see this, you want to go and find out all the films that they've made, and there's a shitload of them.
And I think this was the first Ghibli film I saw.
Yeah.
And it's one of the later ones, really, compared, you know, they did a lot before this.
Which is great.
And I did the same thing. I saw this for the first time at uni, because it came out in, 2000? And then I went back and started going through the Ghibli back catalogue. And
there's loads. Because
this was very much at the height. I mean, I think it was 2003, wasn't it? So this was 2003, 2001, around that time. Very much at the height of when the UK was importing a lot of Japanese things, like PlayStation had come out, Nintendo was becoming the N64s.
Wives. Nintendo. So yeah. Carry on.
And you know, I think we paid a bit more attention to Japanese culture as a whole, and this was one of the things that came over as well, Spirited Away, because had you really heard of a Japanese animation film being in cinemas?
No. And this is, I believe, it's certainly the only anime to win an Oscar. It won Best Animated Film, and I'm pretty sure it's the only one to even be nominated. That's how much it shook up the whole industry, really, that it was that big.
Isn't it the longest ever animated film to win an award as well? I think I read the other day, it's over 2 hours.
Yeah. I mean, it's phenomenal when you think about it. When you look at Ghibli's other work as well, and think it's the only one to win an Oscar.
Yeah, I think others have been nominated since, actually. Yeah. I think Ponyo might have been nominated, but at the time, certainly.
I think Ponyo was, actually, But when you think of the other great animated films of all time, then that was the first one too.
Yeah.
I still need to watch a lot of them. I haven't watched The Wind Rises.
Hmm? Is that the most recent one, Wind Rises?
I think so, yeah. And there's, like you said, there's I know I've seen a few. Is there one called Laputa or something?
Laputa Castle in the Sky.
Just say Castle in the Sky. Beautiful.
In all fair, we can't expect Mark to start trying to pronounce all of these.
I'll never pick one of these as a rewatch, but no. I remember going to, I think I had to get it from CD Wow back in the day. We talked about, they did region 3, and it was the only way you could get them, because they weren't in like your normal shops at the time. And it was just, I remember passing it around to all my mates, like, you need to watch this, it's awesome. And it's
one of the things that I just want to quickly ask you, Ben, just quick, I know it's true of myself at the minute, and Mark, I'm unsure whether you have, you might have done, do apologise if you have. Since watching this, rewatching this again, have you started watching more anime again?
Well, I've been on a whole anime kick at the minute. I've been watching things like Ghost in the Shell again, Akira, all that sort of stuff. I managed to get hold of some DVDs of Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex, which I've never seen. I've been watching Neon Genesis Evangelion. I'm on just a whole Japanese animation kick at the minute, so it's just slotting perfectly in.
Because I've recently started watching things like Parasite, which is stuff I've not seen before. Sword Art Online, which always comes highly recommended. I've started watching that. Literally, ever since watching this, I've just started thinking, you know what? I need to start catching up on some of the animated series.
It always happens. I will not watch any for a while, then I'll watch something, and it kicks me off. I think the reason why I've been on a kick recently is because I ended up watching Cowboy Bebop on your recommendation, and so I'm just mad on my anime again. Always snowballs.
I literally went and bought it after he told me. I've not watched the movie of Cowboy Bebop. I've watched two series, I think, episodes. I've worked my way through them all, but I haven't watched the movie yet. But I just literally, he said it, and I was like, I trust you, I'll buy it.
Yeah, he came up to me and said, oh, it's on Amazon for X amount, and just literally ended up buying the whole thing, didn't you? Yeah.
That's Amazon.
Amazon.
But I bought the whole lot, and I watched them in about a week. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so addictive. But this is the one thing I will do, is I will now try and work my way through all of these.
What, Ghibli?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Have you seen Porco Rosso?
Yes. That, and I've seen Ponyo, which was, if you think this is acidy and a bit weird, Ponyo was, I actually did think I was being spiked.
Ponyo is great.
Ponyo's great. My Neighbor Totoro as well.
Yep.
Good Lord, that's a great film. But just speaking of, going back to Spirited Away for a minute, you were talking about, Mark, when you were wanting to pass your DVD onto friends, saying, yep, watch this. I'm like that. I evangelize about this film. I try and convert people to it. And one of the things, it's the only film I've got with a perfect success rate. No end of films I get people to watch and someone will like it somewhere. This is the only film I know that everyone I've shown it to, yeah, has liked it. Like I was saying to my little brother, who is now, oh God, is he 10 or 11? He's shooting up. Something like that.
Is he? Stop that.
He needs to when he's watching these.
Yeah. He moved to Scotland. That's just what happened. No, he's, you know, he was probably about 8, I think, when I made him watch this. And I didn't know whether he'd dig it or not, because he, you know, he likes things that are a bit more kinetic. But he absolutely loved it. And then he ended up watching it with my mum, and she really loved it. And it just passes,
yeah,
through the generations, both up and down through the generations. Everyone loves it because it just is a masterpiece. And I don't use that word lightly. I know, no, Mark does, but yeah, I don't. It is a masterpiece. And Hayao Miyazaki is a genius to, yep, me. He's a master of his craft.
He is to everyone, yeah, surely. Anyone that sort of knows of his work and, mm-hmm, and has watched his back catalogue of films, you couldn't use any other word to describe, mm-hmm, him. And it is a word that is bandied around too much nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely.
What I really like about it as well is it doesn't look dated.
Yeah.
You know, early animation, you watch Dumbo by Disney, you know it's 50 years old. You know it is. This could have been made 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and you'll watch it in 10 years and still not know. It's perfect.
And it's a brilliant melding of hand-drawn animation. Most of it is hand-drawn, but then it's sort of rendered on a computer. And something I read the other day is the software that they use, Ghibli use, and also the team behind Futurama uses a software called Toons, which is a really sort of high-end animation software. It's free.
They're giving it away.
It's gone freeware. You can now download Toons that Ghibli and Futurama and whatnot use and do your own animation.
So maybe
you still need talent and skill as well. You know, just having the software ain't going to make you the next.
We'll get involved in it. We're going to make an animated feature film now.
So the Play-Doh's out the window. We're going to use Toons.
Yeah. All the stop motion stuff we've been trying. Get rid of that.
Passé, isn't it?
We're just about to finalise that as well. But yeah, this is our new project.
Yeah.
Or we'll just do this podcast. We've animated.
Well, yeah, with us animated on it.
Like Ricky Gervais.
That'll look awful if we did.
Do you want to score this one? Because I think we're going to score very high.
Bro, it's 10 for me.
Oh, yeah.
It's perfect. It's a perfect film. It is beautiful and amazing, and I love it. It's 10.
It's perfect. You know the rule that I have. If it stands the test of time, it gets that final notch.
Yeah.
It gets the notch. It's 10.
You don't need a long reasoning. 10 from me too.
I love it. I love that we've all given this 10. I'm so happy.
So it's Ben's choice, I believe, for the next rewatch. And a perfect 10.
How do you perfect 10?
Birdemic 2.
I'm going to have to get out my tool.
He's literally unzipping his wallet.
To pull out this? A 50 pence piece. So, I have not been able to decide on my film.
Oh my God.
I have two to choose from, both of which factor into what we've been discussing today. We are either going to watch a Will Ferrell comedy, because we talked about Will Ferrell's work earlier, or we are going to reassess a film that has been directed by Zack Snyder. One or the other. So, I'm going to toss this coin... Coin, Mark. I'm going to toss the coin.
Yep.
I'm going to say heads.
Okay.
Is Will Ferrell.
Yep.
And tails.
Yep.
Is Zack Snyder. In fact, I'm going to let you toss the coin. So you know you can be the independent adjudicator. What did I say? Heads, Will Ferrell. Tails, Zack Snyder.
Yep.
What is it?
Tails. Look, Adam. See. Look, listener.
It is tails. I can confirm.
So we are going to critically reappraise a film that a lot of people wrote off. We're going to watch Sucker Punch.
Okay.
Because it was one of those that people saw once or maybe didn't even see and just said, this sucks, and didn't give it its due. So we're going to give it some real thought.
That's good.
We're going to properly, critically appraise this film.
I'm not sure if I'm looking forward to it.
Do you think it'll top Spirited Away?
Well, the weird thing is, it's like Ben just said, I remotely enjoyed it. I thought it was a visual spectacle at the time, but I've only ever seen it once.
Yeah.
Like, I literally did. I walked out the cinema... And then I never gave it a second thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's
something. So it's going to be really curious to watch it again.
Here's something for you both. I've never seen it.
There we go.
So
next time, rewatch Sucker Punch.
Hi there, this is Jim Bowen here, and you're listening to Skip to the End podcast. And now it's time for Raging Bullseye. Listen up, here we go.
the last ever. Oh, well, not necessarily ever, but it's the last one for now. We might bring it back.
Nah, bin it off.
You only say that because you've lost, because I'm already the champion of Raging Bullseye. We've had two rounds. I won both. Standard. But we're playing for dignity. A little bit of self-respect.
I've never,
chaps?
Ever had that.
Just want to say
dignity?
No, ever.
Just want to say quickly, thanks, Jim.
Yep.
Yes, thanks again, Jim. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Been an absolute doll.
So if you haven't listened to the previous episode, you're a mug. Go back and do so. This is how this game works. It's based on the old ITV classic Bullseye, but because we're a movies podcast, it's called Raging Bullseye. And we have a dartboard set up. There are 20 different zones on a dartboard, so we have 20 different questions for each zone. If you hit a single, you get a question. Get it right, you get 1 point. If you hit a double, you get 2 points. If you hit a treble, you get 3. If you hit the ball, either the inner or outer ball, you can pick your topic, but you still only get the maximum 3 points. Does that make sense to everyone?
Yeah.
Are we ready to play?
Yeah.
What we need to do then is reveal the topics. Mark, my glamorous assistant, will you reveal the topics, please? Turn the board around.
I feel a bit like, what's Paul Daniels' wife called? Debbie McGee.
Should we leave Paul out of it since he just died?
Well, I'm talking about his wife. But
his grieving widow, you mean?
I feel a bit like her.
Stop. Just stop. There we go.
So there's our list of 20 topics. Just to give the audience an idea of what's out there, we've got things like Studio Ghibli is number 4. We've got Rocky is number 10. We've got Adam Sandler movies is number 12. And any on there that you guys particularly look forward to? Maybe Rebel Wilson at number 18.
Number 20. Ridley Scott.
Number 20, The Ridley Room. Scott.
Yeah, number 20, The Room. And Chuck Norris, number 9. That could be a biggie. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to John Carpenter.
Yeah, so who was going to throw first?
Mark, you're near. You're already near, so feel free.
Away you go. Mark has hit what looks to be a single 14.
It is.
And 14 is the Oscars.
Worst topic ever.
Okay. So, Mark, who in history has won the most Oscars?
Steven Spielberg.
It's Walt Disney with 22. Yeah.
That's unsurprising, actually, when you think about it.
Indeed. Adam, step up to the hockey. Adam has hit a single, is that 11?
Yep.
And 11 is Pixar.
Let's go.
Adam, what was the first theatrical Pixar movie?
Theatrical?
Yep.
Toy Story?
Correct. Well done.
Bastard.
1 point to Adam. Mark, second throw.
I thought it was too obvious. I was like, The Room.
Mark has hit a single 20, which is The Room. Ooh.
I aim for that.
Now, Mark, this is pretty much your specialist subject, I would say.
Yeah, but it's going to shaft me. It'll be something I don't know. The one thing I don't know about The Room.
Here we go, then. What, in dollars, was the budget for The Room?
$6 million?
Correct. Oh. He is a Room nerd. He knows it all.
He was definitely going to get that one.
So that's one all.
Tommy's assistant.
Adam for his second throw.
Allegedly $6 million.
Well, you can see it all on screen, Mark. It clearly costs $6 million.
No aiming for damage.
Go for musical as number 8, Adam. What have you got?
Treble 8.
So it is musicals. So this is for 3 points.
Oh, no.
Which musical won Best Film at the 2003 Oscars?
Ooh.
For 3 points. To take a lead.
Hairspray?
Oh, and look, it's Chicago.
Oh.
Mark, third throw. Is that a single 18?
Yeah.
Rebel Wilson.
Rebel Wilson is the topic.
This is a big one.
Rebel Wilson plays the sister of Matt Lucas in which film?
Plays the sister of Matt Lucas.
Yeah. Matt Lucas of Shooting Stars and Little Britain fame.
Has he been in a film?
Several. He was in that abominable Alice in Wonderland film, wasn't he?
So he's like, is it that?
Yeah, it's well done. It's annoying, I don't know.
Bridesmaids.
Oh. Yeah. Now you've said it, I can picture it, that scene all the way.
Yeah, that scene with those two.
Away you go, Adam. Is this his third throw?
Yeah.
Scores stand at one apiece. Single 4.
Oh, how?
Studio Ghibli.
Topical.
Yeah. Going to test my language skills here. Sen to Chihiro no Kamakakushi is the Japanese title of which Ghibli film?
So what was getting...
Sen to Chihiro no Kamakakushi. Is the Japanese title...
My Neighbor Totoro?
It's Spirited Away.
Oh.
Sen to Chihiro no Kamakakushi, the spiriting away of Sen and Chihiro.
I knew that.
Mark hits. Is that a treble?
Oh, no. So close.
What is it? A single two?
Single two.
Quentin Tarantino. Who played Oren Ishii in Kill Bill?
Lucy Liu.
Correct. Oh. Mark takes a lead, 2-1. Adam with his fourth throw. Single 10 is Rocky.
Is this as in the boxer or Bullwinkle Rocky?
Well, have to wait and see.
Or the chocolate bar.
Who played Ivan Drago in Rocky IV?
Dolph Lundgren.
It is Dolph Lundgren. And that is the second Dolph Lundgren-based question we've had in consecutive episodes.
Two-all.
It is 2-2. Mark, fifth throw. Fifth and final throw.
Might have to go to a darts off.
Uh-huh. What have you got there?
Three.
Is that single three?
Video game movies.
Video game movies. Kylie Minogue played which character in Street Fighter?
Chun-Li.
Does she look very oriental to you?
It's Cammy.
It is Cammy, Adam. Well done.
Chun-Li?
Well, I thought I said Blanca.
Is she Mark's then?
Right, final throw, Adam. So is it 2-1 to Mark at the minute?
No, it's 2-2.
Oh, 2-2, okay.
To win it.
Time for the win. Is that a bull?
Out of bull.
Holy moly, you get to pick, brother. This is for the win. You get to pick your topic.
Oh, shit. What's my best?
Well, look at number one, man. It's made for you.
Yeah, we'll go Dark Knight Trilogy.
You're going to go Dark Knight Trilogy number one?
To. Yeah.
It is trickier than you thought. How many Oscars did the trilogy win?
One.
It's two.
Score.
I think it was editing, actually. It was editing. Obviously
Heath Ledger
won, yeah, and it was one of the below-the-line categories. Both were for Dark Knight. So it's 2-2.
It's a darts off.
It's a darts off. So the way we're going to play this is you each get three darts, highest score wins. If it's a tie, it's a tops-off wrestle.
No one wants to see that.
Nine. What's that, Mark? Is that treble 13?
Treble 13.
Which is what? 36 plus 9 is 40. Sorry, 39 plus 9 is 48. Plus another 9 is 57. Not bad, Mark. Not bad.
That's a pretty good score.
Solid darts.
Not bad.
See if I can just treble 20.
That would have got me a caravan.
Your score to beat is 57.
I'm pretty confident with that, if I'm honest.
Five. Oh, treble 18,
yeah.
Which is 8, 16, 24, 54 plus 5 is 59. He's already won. This is just for glory.
Six.
So that's 65.
Oh.
Adam is the champion. Mark, once again, the wooden spoon belongs to you, my friend.
Oh. Yay, good. Second place.
Good darts, though, lads. Good darts.
That was fun.
Just happy we had a darts off.
Yeah,
me too. Thanks again to Jim Bowen for his contributions to the last few episodes. But it's time for a new game. And I've come up with one. I'm not going to tell you what it is yet, but I am going to tell you the title. The title of our new game, in 2 weeks' time, is The Imitation Game.
Thank you for listening to Skip to the End podcast. This is Jim Bowen, completely fed up, and I'm going home now.
Listener questions time. First of all, I think it's a new listener, Ben Bowman. If you could improve the special effects from an older film with the CGI of today and the technology, what would you choose?
Avengers Age of Ultron.
Or for the lips on Ultron.
The technology that's improved about 6 months later.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah.
It's hard to say because...
We're notoriously against it, really, aren't
we're
we?
We're notoriously against CGI, especially modern CGI, because it's never as good as you think it is. Like, we saw a trailer today for Tarzan, and Mark, you turned to me and said that it looked terrible.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely right. The bit of Tarzan swinging through the trees, it looked like the first Spider-Man film, which is awful. So it's hard to say. And it depends how you look at old CGI or old graphics. If you look at something like Jason and the Argonauts, I don't know if you remember that, but that had all the creature effects were done by, I think it was Ray Harryhausen, and the skeletons that come up from the ground, they look herky-jerky, but they look brilliant for their time. And I wouldn't want to change those. No. I wouldn't want to replace those with CGI. And then you have films that just have horrendous CGI, like Matrix 3, that I wouldn't want to replace because it's just too funny. So I don't know. I think the answer to that is I wouldn't bother. Just leave it as it is.
It's difficult, isn't it?
For me, I watched a film that everyone's telling me I should have seen called The Last Starfighter, which was one of the first 80s films to use CGI. I would love now, because they helped bring CGI. I'd love to go back with extra resources now and make it look better. But the one film that I think suffers from bad CGI is The Mist. I think it's a great film, but I hate that bloody worm thing. You know, that when it's coming, I just didn't like it. And I think that's such a good film, and the acting's great, and the story's great. It always lets me down. So I'd have gone and spent a little bit more money on that.
Do you know what I would say? We and everyone has a go at George Lucas for going back and changing his original trilogy of Star Wars and putting in unnecessary things.
Rightfully so.
The one thing I would say that he did well is some of the scenes, the aerial fighting scenes for the X-Wings, when you're in the pilot seat and you're looking out through the window. In the original versions of the original trilogy, the sort of space outside the window looked a bit ropey. It looked really badly done. So when he went and redid that, it looked better, a lot cleaner, like they were flying through space. That was the one thing that was worthwhile. Everything else he changed was garbage.
Oh, yeah, but Aiden Christensen in the last scene.
Ugh, that, Christ.
That people have sold their Blu-rays for that.
Let's not get angry about that again.
That is a rabbit hole we don't have time to go into.
A big friend of the podcast, regular listener, Liz Marshall.
So regular, we can't pronounce it.
There's news of a fifth Indiana Jones film being made.
Oh, Christ.
Why? Just why? Thoughts? I think Ben summed it up perfectly.
Because they've run out of ideas.
What, Hollywood in general has run out of ideas? Yeah.
So they're just going, what did kids love 30 years ago? Let's do it.
And also I think it's because Harrison Ford in the last 5-6 years has just stopped being a grumpy old bastard and has been willing to revisit his old roles again.
Yeah.
So, you know, while he's up for it, get him in.
Yeah, it's got to be like, I'd tell you, normally it'd have to be a decent script, but Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Well, and it's the same writer from that. It's already confirmed he's doing this.
I'll tell you what, there better bloody be a scene where a nuclear bomb goes off and he survives it by getting in a fridge. If there's not one of those, I'm not watching it.
I'm just hoping, and this is a real, real big dream of mine, that the aliens from Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, when they flew off, come back and start instigating trade negotiations with Earth.
Ooh.
Indiana Jones and the courtroom.
Indiana Jones.
A whole 2 hours of them in a courtroom.
Indiana Jones and the European Economic Area Trade Shipment Negotiation.
See, that
would
be good.
Sign me up.
Felix on Twitter has put, there are rumours of Captain Britain getting his own TV show. Out of all the characters from Marvel and DC, this is definitely for you two, who deserves their own?
It's hard to say because of the proliferation of comic book movies and TV shows of late. So many bases have been covered.
Yeah.
Who's left? Who of any worth really is left?
The Captain Britain thing sounds interesting. I think if they're going to go down that sort of road, they've done like an animated feature, but I'd love to see a TV series of like Red Son.
Yeah.
Superman Red Son. Yeah. I think that'd be fantastic. Just to see the alternate sort of DC timeline with Superman in Soviet era Russia.
Mm-hmm. I think in terms of characters who we haven't seen yet in any way, shape or form, it's really villains, I think. Like, I would love to see a representation of Carnage.
Yeah.
Carnage was always my favourite Superman villain, so I'd like to see him used. And Darkseid as well, you know, I think odds are Darkseid's going to end up coming in the Justice League.
That way.
So there are people I'd like to see. But speaking of modern representations of DC and Marvel characters, have you guys watched season 2 of Daredevil yet?
I'm 4 episodes in.
Mark? I'm 6 episodes in.
I've done all 13.
Of course you have.
Of course.
In a day.
In one day. And we'll keep this spoiler-free for the listeners and for yourselves. Based on what you've seen so far, thoughts? Enjoying it compared to the first season? What are you thinking?
Yeah, I think so. It's pretty good so far. I like Castle.
Yes. John Bernthal is absolutely brilliant as Punisher, as Frank Castle.
What I've seen of him is brutal. The introduction on episode 2, when you see him properly going into the sort of trade shop to get a gun, I just thought to myself, I'm sold on this character now, and it's on episode 2.
Yeah.
So I can't wait to see what happens.
As an absolute nerd for the Punisher character, this is the 4th TV or film version of him. Best one by a country mile. The only
decent
one.
I was going to say, there's not
one.
Really many.
No.
Much competition, though, isn't
there? The 3 film versions are atrocities.
Who's it played him in Warzone?
Ray Stevenson played him in Warzone.
If I remember watching that, it wasn't too bad.
That film was okay, purely because they took a lot of the story from Garth Ennis's run on Punisher, which is the definitive Punisher run. So the story was good. And Ray Stevenson's fine, but it just didn't coalesce. But John Bernthal is Frank Castle to me. And you'll see as you go through it, he just gets better and better. There are other things later on in the season that don't quite work for me. Elektra comes more to the fore and she doesn't quite work for me. But some characters return from season 1 later on and so on. So keep with it. I don't think it's as good as season 1, but it's still very good. I enjoyed it.
I'm trying to drag it out. I don't want it to be all gone too soon.
That's the problem, because I watched it all in one day and then I was like, oh, it's gone now. I've got to wait a year, have I?
Jess Wirral. Guys, you're up to episode 40. What's been your favourite episode?
Oh, God. Hard to say.
This is a real tough one because I'd have to listen to them all again, and I haven't got time for that.
I think my favourite episode is the next one.
Oh, look at that. Always looking forward.
I always look forward to meeting up with you guys again and reviewing a film and having a chat.
I don't want to just toot our own horn, but I think everything we've put out this calendar year has been a cut above everything we did last year. I just think we've got gradually better. And I, because I'm a narcissist, sat and listened to our last five episodes last weekend because I was hungover and couldn't get out of bed. So I thought, I'll just listen to myself talk. And it was brilliant. I loved all of it.
What was the episode before Annalisa? Was it Grimsby?
Oh, yeah.
I really enjoy that episode.
It was a great episode. Yeah. A terrible film, but a great episode. So
that's one of my favourites. But
There was one we did. It was not Christmas Gone, Christmas Before. And our Christmas special, we watched Dumb and Dumber 2, which is a stone cold atrocity of a film. It was before we had microphones. We were recording on our iPhone. So it sounds ropey, but we had so much fun.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
We'd had a few beers. We had a laugh. It was Secret just a great Santa. Secret Santa we did. And I think it was possibly the first episode where we were entirely ourselves.
Yeah.
We weren't trying to be kind of radio presenters. We were just us talking shit. And it was so much fun. I've not listened back to it in a year. No. It might sound god awful, but I remember it being great fun.
I was pretty drunk. I had 3 cans of beer that day.
He was hammered. That'd be like Adam, you or I being on heroin.
Yeah.
Carl Highland, do you guys have a favourite DVD extra or deleted scene? Now, I know you don't buy many films, do you? You always borrow them off me.
well, back in the DVD days, I had an extensive DVD collection, several hundred DVDs. And then Blu-rays came out, and because I'm a grumpy shit, I was like, I'm not paying again to buy the same film I already own on a different medium. So I've never owned a Blu-ray, I've never purchased one, never needed to. And then, you know, we got into a digital age with streaming and whatnot. So I sold all my DVDs. So now I don't really own DVDs or Blu-rays at all. I watch everything online in some way, shape or form.
I bought the Alien box set on Blu-ray, and that's the best ever features. And it's got the director's cut and the original cut on each disc. So that's incredible, and it's worth every penny. But the best
one... It's not really a feature, though, is it? It's more the movie.
I suppose it's a feature of having the choice.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I don't really pay attention to a lot of the extra features on things. I know you do because you're quite a nerd with it, aren't you? You actually love sitting down. It's not an insult. I'm a nerd with comic books. You love sitting down and kind of going through
some of
everything.
The making ofs.
But I watch some of the makings of for films, but I don't really necessarily extrapolate a difference between one making of and another making of.
No,
I just kind of watch them and go, oh, cool.
Yeah.
On my Watchmen Blu-ray, the one thing I do want to point out, there's a maximum movie mode where you got Schneider in the corner talking about every single scene, and he's got his graphic novel and he's saying how he did it. And if you really are
a
diehard fan, he literally goes into every detail.
That sounds hideous. That sounds like it really pissed me off. Just him in the bottom right corner has been yapping throughout the whole film.
It's like when you watch the news and stuff, and for deaf people and there's someone in the corner, it's more...
why is that only ever the case at like 5 a.m? Are deaf people only up in the middle of the night?
Yeah.
Are they nocturnal, deaf people?
Yeah, they're alarm.
Is that one of their powers?
Their alarm clocks don't go off.
At @jazz_pirate, your favourite movie ghost?
Ah, oh, Slimer. Got to be Slimer, isn't it?
It is, that's a fact. You can't go against it. But I do like in John Carpenter's Fog, the shadows that come with the red eyes. Mm. They're really creepy. But it's religion, it's Slimer. That's it.
Adam?
Patrick Swayze.
No, Slimer.
No, it's got to be Slimer.
Yeah.
In the original Ghostbusters, not just new.
Well, we've only seen the new 3 minutes, if that, of the new one.
Yeah.
We don't know if it's going to be any good or bad.
We will find out soon enough.
And will we be reviewing that?
Well, schedules change. Yeah. Our schedule might change, the release schedule might change, but at the minute... Ghostbusters, the remake, is on track to be our review on episode 50.
It's a good one to end on, isn't it?
End on.
It's a good one.
The nifty 50s.
Timbo 42.
Timbo!
Timbo!
What film during the year of your birth do you wish you could now see at the cinema?
Die Hard.
Well, yeah, Adam's already covered it.
I'm a bit older. I'm 1982. And I'm not going to say the obvious, because it would have been The Thing.
Well, The Thing, yeah.
But I'm going to be different, because I talk about it too much. Poltergeist.
Yeah. You'd see, 82, you're on a roll, because you could have had The Thing, Poltergeist, Blade Runner. Yeah.
And E.T.
I'm 83, so I've got Return of the Jedi. So I'm happy. Just me and the Ewoks kicking it.
You look good for 83.
Cheers, man.
Sarah Groom, when you guys have your first child...
What, together?
That is a bit, you know, yeah, medical science needs to move on a fair way for that.
What would be
going to carry it?
What would
you are Danny DeVito. We've seen twins.
What would be your first father and son movie you'd be wanting to sit down and show your son for the first time? That's a toughie.
That is a toughie.
The Room.
No. I guess, you know, I'm kind of lucky because I've got a very young little brother. So I've been able to do that. I've been able to, like we talked earlier, I've been able to sit down and watch Spirited Away with him and things like that.
It's going to be difficult because we all know how I feel about films, and if they don't like them, I basically get rid. So if I sit a kid down to watch, my child down to watch Star Wars, and he doesn't like it,
get rid.
He's gone.
is there an upper limit when you can adopt a child out?
I don't know.
Because if you sit down with your kid and they're 13 and they don't like Star Wars, you should still be able to just shunt them off, shouldn't you?
Yeah.
Jog on.
Refund.
Kick them out.
Yeah.
Boarding school.
Predator.
Like, listen, son. You know I'm your father. You're going to hear a lot of people refer to me as a predator, so we're going to watch Predator.
Yeah, luckily my girlfriend's 7, so Predator would be perfect for that. That was a joke, by the way, before you get me in trouble. Or Commando, that would be great. Just introduce him to Arnie. That's it. That's all the questions for this week. So keep your questions coming. Twitter's the best way to get hold of us, at STTE Podcast, but also Facebook /SkipTheEndPodcast, or email us podcast@skiptheend.co.uk.
So that brings us to the end of another episode of the Skip to the End Podcast. Do you know, that review of Batman versus Superman might be the longest review we've done in a while.
Yeah, we're usually quite short and sweet.
Short and sweet, short and snappy.
We couldn't be with that, could we?
There was a lot to sort of dissect and go through, really.
I think Gone Girl was literally pushing on 40, 45 minutes, but then we started to realise we didn't...
That's because we thought we were Mark Kermode or something, had to do these highfalutin reviews talking about the mise-en-scene and all this shit, and then we realised, nah, that's not us. Let's not do that. So yeah, to do like a half an hour review, whatever it turned out.
Yeah, had to be.
Good stuff. Good,
yeah, it was all good stuff.
Well done, boys. Well,
let's keep it all in, shall we?
Definitely. Longer is better. Yeah, longer is definitely better.
That's what I've heard. What are we going to review next time, Adam?
We're reviewing Hardcore Henry.
Hardcore Henry, which looks a very odd one, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether it's going to be good or not, but it's certainly going to be interesting to watch just for the whole first person aspect of it all.
This is precisely it. This is kind of why we've decided to review it, not because it might be a good film. I think the reviews that I've heard so far say it's pretty good, but it's more the fact that it's so weird in terms of production, the fact that it is all shot from first... It looks like you're playing Doom or something.
It's literally an action version of Peep Show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's hope it's more like Peep Show than the film version of Doom.
Well, yeah. Let's hope David Mitchell's in the lead role.
I'd love that. I'd definitely watch that. Mark, what's our topic?
Top 3 sports movies.
Yeah, man. That's going to take a bit of while to think about because there are so many. Yeah.
And I hope there's not many crossovers. I like hearing
Wimbledon,
more.
Wimbledon.
Bloody love that film.
I don't think I know anyone that's ever seen that film. Ever.
Is it Kirsten Dunst that's in that
film?
Yeah,
it's
Paul Bettany.
It used to always be on like ITV2 around Wimbledon time.
Well, as if makes sense.
I assume they're just hoping people get confused and put it on. It's like, highlights from Wimbledon.
Maybe it's on Netflix.
Oh, I hate you so much.
1987 as well. That's the skip back. That's
we are skipping back to 87. I'm sure it's going to be a good year. If it's anything like 88, it's going to be a hell of a year. It's my rewatch choice. We tossed a coin. We're going to be rewatching Zack Snyder's Sucker Punch, which I think deserves a critical reappraisal. It's a film that was just written off, I think, too easily. It might turn out that we all think it's absolute shite.
But at least we've given it fair crack.
Exactly right. We're going to be fairer to it than the critics were, I think. We're going to give it a chance. And we might be the only people on Earth who will then have seen it twice, you and I, Adam.
I think we would be.
Yeah. Or did you say you've seen this one or
not?
Yeah,
seen it.
That's right, yeah.
I'm going in dry.
That's what she said.
What did she say that?
So we've also got a brand new quiz next time. It is called The Imitation Game.
Looking forward to finding out a bit more about that.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm going to bring the rules to you on the day. We'll let our dear listeners figure out what that might be. What do you think it's going to be, really? Think of the name, you know, put it together. Ain't that odd, is it? And there'll be a whole other bunch of malarkey. We'll take listener questions. We'll give away a prize. It's all going to be utterly delightful.
I'm just thinking, if Ben does 10 questions on the film, The Imitation Game, worst quiz ever.
It is. It's questions about Benedict Cumberbatch. That's it.
That is shit.
I assure you it'll be a little bit more fun than that. So we'll see you in 2 weeks.